Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with Stephen Boykowicz. He is the communications director for the National Guest Worker Alliance. We're going to be talking about the Hershey situation. Look, you know, we've been talking a lot about this because I think it's important. It's one of these things that nationally should have been picked up. I don't know that it's gotten as much news as I think it should have, but at the end of the day, it's talking about labor relations in this country and the layers and layers and layers that are going on really to screw workers. I mean, this whole thing, these kids on this J-1 visa program coming over here from other countries to try and experience what life in America is like, being put in a sweatshop, is that really what we're about? But didn't you look at how the corporate structure is? It wasn't Hershey. No, we leased that out to some company who, you know, managed the warehouse, who leased that out to someone who managed the employees, who leased that out to someone who actually went out and got them. So it's not my fault, and it's not his fault. It's not his fault. It's nobody's fault. It's the workers' fault. They should have read the fine print. That was finally what they came down with. Well, they should have read the fine print. They should have known. Granted, it was in English, in very small print, and these are people who English, not their first language, they want to come here to learn it. So it'll be interesting to talk with Stephen about that and what's going on, where we go from here, the whole nine yards. Also tonight, Mark Anderson from Daily Kos Labor going to be here talking about the attacks on union members and teachers in Wisconsin and across the country. Sarah Jaffe is going to be here from Alternet talking about the Bank of America death watch, because there are some who believe that Bank of America is in a death spiral. And the question then becomes, are they too big to fail? Are we going to bail them out again, or will they collapse? And what does that mean for the banking industry as a whole? So we'll talk to Sarah Jaffe about that. And also in the third hour, Casey Miner. He's a reporter where he reports on transportation for KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. If you remember, we talked about the whole BART transportation thing there, where they shut off the cell phone lines and the internet and all communications because they were afraid. You know, there are a handful of people going to come and protest, and we want to make sure that we can quash that protest, and we don't want any messaging getting out. So we'll talk about that, because there have been some big arrests, I guess, going on there as well. So the big news today, did you feel it? Did you feel the earthquake this afternoon? Sometime around 3:30, 3:35. They tell me the ground shook a bit. Here in the studio, it was just enough to get our chief executive board op over here, Brett's attention. Personally, I didn't feel it. But then again, you know, for me to feel some of those things, I guess things would have to be falling off the walls. But here again, you know, we walked outside, talked to some people, and yeah, they felt it. In fact, some people in the higher up buildings felt it a little more and went racing outside. So an interesting day First thing I thought of, to be honest, because it's just how my mind works, I thought of Eric Cantor. And I thought of some of the Republicans wanting to destroy regulations, wanting to take, any warning systems away. And you think I'm kidding. It's not. You look at in Virginia, they've got a couple of nuke plants. The North Anna nuke plant, for instance, which evidently lost power. And you go back and you go, it lost power. I had to go to a diesel backup, which it's supposed to do, and it worked fine, and everything is fine. I'm not going to get into that, oh, we were on the precipice of a destruction. No. It worked the way it was supposed to. But here, what happened was, back in the 90s, when you had these massive budget cuts, according to the Virginia Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy, the Virginia Tech Seismological Observation Area was taken away, removed, all the seismographs, everything from around the plant gone, budget cuts. And you go back to March of this year, where the Examiner reported, because you remember, Japan had just happened, and they were worried, well, what would happen if we had something like that? How prepared are we here at home? And they pointed out that Eric Cantor had defended the Republicans defunding proposals to cut spending for the U.S. Geological Survey, the National Weather Service, the NOAA, and a whole bunch of programs that, would A, give us early warning, and B, maybe detect some of this stuff. So the idea, get rid of it. The idea is, cut, slash, burn, all of that. This way we can save money. And, I didn't see any buildings fall. We were watching the news a little bit, paying attention to the reports coming out of D.C. Some cell towers didn't do so well. Cell activity disrupted a little bit. Part of that has to do with everybody calling home all at once and overloading the system a little bit, but also had some problems. But no buildings collapsed. No mass catastrophes, no massive fires, no groundbreaking, nothing. In fact, the pictures that I've been seeing coming across the internet are actually kind of funny. A lawn chair was knocked over, and oh, we need to rebuild because we had this 5.8, 5.9 earthquake, which is a pretty sizable earthquake, especially if it happened in Virginia and we felt it here in Pennsylvania. And I go back to this moment. I go back to the Eric Cantors. I go back to the radical right wing, and I stop and think. I go, well, what happened if we were to follow their vision? If we were to follow the Republicans' way of thinking, which is we don't have any oversight over anything. Things just happen. The invisible hand takes care of it all. The invisible hand guides us. So if Rick Smith wants to put up a structure 50 foot high and use toothpicks to do it, let him do it. Now, granted, if something like this were to happen and that 50-foot toothpick building were to fall over and kill somebody, well, that's something that, you'll figure it out. And I look at the fact that no buildings came down. No massive chaos. There were a couple of cups turned over. Saw pictures of that. Saw pictures of, some mild mischief, things knocked over, trash cans over, stuff like that, coffee cups spilled. But not what you would expect if this were to happen in a place like Haiti, for instance, or in a place that didn't have the kind of building codes that we have. And, when you have things like this happen, you go, it's a good thing we had smart policies. It's a good thing somebody was paying attention. It's a good thing that maybe we were paying attention when they were pouring the concrete for the bridges. Maybe we were paying attention when they built those buildings. And, the more I thought about it today, the more I was thinking, here in Harrisburg, I didn't hear any sirens. There was no rushing around. There was no massive damage. And, on the Twitters, our chief executive over, Brett here, he was monitoring the goings on there on Twitter. And one of the people had mentioned that they hadn't heard any sirens. Probably because there was nobody calling because there was any damage, but it got me to thinking. What if we had a disaster? Like a major earthquake. And there was massive damage and there was death and destruction and there was pain and suffering and nobody came. I mean, at this point, when we're listening to the Republicans talking about we need to cut, gut, and punish. We need to slash and burn. We need to gut government spending. We need to put the hands back in the money back in the hands of the job creators, which they'll just pocket or create jobs overseas. We've already seen that. That's done deal. But what if nobody came? Because you look at places like we had talked about in the past, Missouri, for instance, where one guy's house was burning down. The fire department showed up. Sorry, you don't, you're not a subscriber. We're not going to put water on your house. That's where this all leads us, to conservative world, where there's nothing that the public does. It's all for profit. It's all private. So if you have this mass catastrophe, how do you react? I guess you're on your own, brother. And in conservative world, that's the mantra. You're on your own. Not going to be any help from us. There'll be no sirens coming to help. And I looked at today, and I have to be honest, it solidifies my belief in we the people. It solidifies my belief in community. It solidifies my belief in government of, for, and by we the people. Our government. Not the government. Like the right loves to say, well, that's the government. No, it's our government. We, us. Not some divorced entity out on an island somewhere. It's all of us. And today, smart regulation, smart policy saved lives. Unquestioningly. So I'm going to finish up this segment with the Borowitz Report. Andy Borowitz reports that seismologists said today that a 5.8 magnitude earthquake centered in Virginia did less damage to Washington, D.C. than House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, also centered in Virginia. Davis Logsdon of the University of Minnesota's Seismology Institute said the earthquake and Eric Cantor originate from the almost identical point. But while the earthquake caused some minor shaking, there's only one word for Eric Cantor's impact. Devastation. As residents of Washington picked up the rebel left through behind from by Representative Cantor, some questioned whether it made any sense to rebuild at all. One resident said, you know, what's the point? Congress is back from recess in a few days, and he'll just knock everything down again. While rubbling from the earthquake extended from states far-flung as New York and Ohio, Representative Cantor's path of destruction has wreaked damage on almost every state in the country, according to Dr. Logsdon. One resident says the only state that hasn't been destroyed is Wisconsin, because there, nothing was left. Nothing was left after it was hit by Scott Walker. So there you go. But today, smart policy wins out. I didn't see any buildings down. If you did, give me a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you want to share your hurricane stories, your earthquake stories, by all means, give me a call. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Stephen Boykowicz, National Guest Worker Alliance, right back after this.
Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The battle continues, and we must stay united until we get a fair contract. I want to thank all of my union brothers and sisters, both from landline and the wireless side, for their support in this fight. This is a true David and Goliath story being played out right now. David will once again win.
CWA Local 1101's Danny Gutierrez on the Verizon strike ending today. Striking Verizon workers return to work today under indefinite extensions of their existing collective bargaining agreements. Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says the unity that striking CWA and IBEW workers demonstrated in their two-week strike will continue, along with continued union mobilization, until the new collective bargaining agreement is won at Verizon.
That will go on not only until we have a decent contract, but until working people feel like they can join a union, any union, and bargain with their head held high across this country. We should return united as much as we can. marching in together, literally, at the start of a shift. For now, our unity will be to support the bargaining team and to show it. But if that process doesn't work in the weeks ahead, management absolutely knows that that unity will again be directed at them.
Cohen says the unions and working Americans everywhere need to build a new democracy movement to battle corporate power's assault on the middle class. Miles Calvi is IBEW Local 2222 business manager.
In good faith, we've decided to have our members go back and see if we can at least change the process. The process up to this point has been 100% concessionary, and as we explained to the company, even if we were crazy enough to come to a tentative agreement, it would never be accepted by the membership, so it was a complete waste of time.
He says a company like Verizon, with more than $106 billion a year in revenue, can't just dump health care costs on the backs of workers.
When a corporation that brings in $107 billion a year and has operating income profits of over $3 billion, if they decide that they're not going to help out on the health care issues, then we are in serious trouble.
Calvi says as Verizon workers get back to work and collective bargaining resumes, the public can help the unions build a democracy movement that defends the dream of a strong American middle class.
Any communication they have with Verizon, just tell them how outrageous it was that it wasn't just an attack on their employees, it's an attack on the middle class in this country.
The AFL-CIO is submitting more than 21,000 public comments from workers who want to see new NLRB union election rules adopted. The proposed rules would speed up union elections and help ensure that workers who want to vote to have a union have a fair choice. The AFL-CIO says working people overwhelmingly support the new NLRB election standards, despite a torrent of politically motivated attacks on the rules from companies and anti-union organizations. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You remember last Wednesday we were out in Palmyra with the kids who came out of the Excel plant owned by Hershey. And again, this whole layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, finger pointing and all that going on. Where at the end of the day, these kids, these J-1 visa kids who have come from all around the world to want to experience our country, being thrown into sweatshops. And I look at the board of directors, the trust's board of directors. I look at what they made in 2009, 2010. Their chairman, Leroy Zimmerman, $510,000. One of their other guys, James Neville's, $541,000. Robert Kavanaugh, $331,000. Velma Redmond, almost $150,000. You look at all this money going to these people who go to a couple of meetings a year. And then you compare that to the $8.25 an hour they pay these kids from around the world. Kind of makes you wonder. What kind of priorities we've got. That's why I've asked Stephen Boykovich to come and talk to us. He's the communications director with the National Guest Worker Alliance. Guestworkeralliance.org is the website. Stephen, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for giving me a chance to talk about this campaign.
So how did this whole thing start? How did it come to your attention? Walk me through this.
Well, it's a pretty interesting case. As you and a lot of your listeners know, about 3 months ago, this group of 400 students came from all around the world, having paid between $3,000 and $6,000 apiece for what was meant to be a cultural exchange program. They were on a visa called the J-1 visa. The only reason the J-1 exists is for cultural exchange. It was invented by the State Department in 1961, or rather, by Congress in 1961 to help the U.S. win the Cold War. Administered by the State Department, not a guest worker visa, not a work program. The students understood there would be work involved, but they paid what in their home countries is really extraordinary amounts of money for a chance to learn English, to broaden their cultural horizons, and to experience real American culture. When they found themselves essentially captive laborers in the Hershey's packing plant in Palmyra, with massive debt hanging over their heads, the equivalent of between $1 and $3 an hour as their wages after mandatory company deduction, including company housing they had no choice whether or not to live in for $395 a bed per month. Really being worked beyond the point of physical breakdown for these students, 18 to 22, some of them barely 100 pounds, and bruising up and down their arms, chronic exhaustion. I was told by a Mongolian student how a pretty big, strong guy among these students, how he's been sleeping on the floor for several days because his back ached so badly he couldn't sleep on a mattress. When they made any expressions of concern to their supervisors, to the sponsoring organization, they were met with threats of deportation. So one of them, after several weeks of this, went into a legal aid clinic in Harrisburg, just off the street, not really knowing at all what sort of help he might find. And the legal aid lawyer happened to know our folks down in New Orleans. It's where the National Guest Worker Alliance is based, so we have campaigns all around the country.
Right.
And we understood this is a situation, though we hadn't worked with J-1 students before, this is a situation of essentially captive labor that we have seen all around the country with other guest workers, and that's when we came up and started to help the students organize.
You know, when we reported on this Wednesday night, we got a number of emails from people saying, you know, we knew this was happening there for years. We knew it's been happening over at this campground. It's been happening at this other facility. And people started talking about it. And I got to be honest, it's one of these snowballing things. Once one of these dominoes falls, other people come out of the woodwork and say, oh, yeah, I know about that. So is there any movement now to really look at this J-1 visa program and to go and make sure that no kid gets the screw job like these kids have gotten?
Well, Rick, this is the really incredible thing. We, as you can imagine, are hearing the same thing that you're hearing every day. Two things happened as of Wednesday when the students announced their strike. Number one was a pretty extraordinary outpouring of support from folks in Hershey all around central Pennsylvania and around the country as well. But, you know, I would hear all the time from community folks, from journalists saying, you know, this is a really extraordinary response, the way people are connecting with these students, understanding essentially that they're experiencing the kind of consequences of decades of corporate greed, decades of downsizing, outsourcing, and subcontracting for the cheapest, most exploitable labor possible that folks in central Pennsylvania and around the country, unfortunately, know all too well.
Yep.
So there was this outpouring of support for the students in solidarity, really fantastic support from organized labor from all sides. And then the second thing we heard was this extraordinary outpouring of stories from current and former J-1s, from community folks who've been seeing this, who haven't known whom to go to. Hershey's wants to treat this like, first of all, not its business, not its responsibility in any way. Everybody wants to treat this as a sort of fluke, but you've heard the stories. You know this is not a fluke.
This is Hershey's fault. This is bottom line. This is Hershey's fault. I don't buy the whole, we contracted out and we have a code of conduct nonsense. You knew it was going on. It's been going on for years. Those companies have been abusing program after program after program, and you've just turned a blind cheek. And like I pointed out at the beginning, look at the massive salaries being taken by their board of directors for doing almost no work whatsoever. And you got these kids who are busting their behinds. They wanted a cultural experience. Well, I'll tell you something. They got our cultural experience, hard work and no pay.
I tell you what, we've heard that again and again and again, folks saying, listen, now you understand what America is like for all too many people. But the other, fortunately, there's another side to this. What the students have said, what they said when they came out of the factory on Friday was, you know, Hershey showed us the worst of American culture. They showed us corporate greed. Ordinary Americans who came out to support the workers when they were organizing and obviously have stepped up in enormous numbers since they came out to the public are showing them the best of America.
And that's a great point. And I'm glad you made that. So let me ask you this. What's going to happen to these kids? You know, I was there and it was an amazing moment to see those kids come out of the factory, and, you know, and stand together in solidarity with one another. But here, as I understand, in a couple of days, they're going to be going home with this experience. Hopefully they take it with them and they begin organizing at home. But what's going to happen to these kids?
Well, it's interesting. There is, there's a perception some folks have that this is, you know, in a couple of days, all these students are gone. That's actually not at all the case. There are a number that are scheduled to go home. Their visa term ends, on September 1st. There are others that are around for another month or even 2 months. So, including some of the strongest leaders and the strongest organizers in the group. So, if Hershey's and its subcontractors think that this is a movement, this is a story, this is a source of public pressure to actually not only end exploitation of student workers, but also to insist on living wage jobs for local workers, good quality jobs with rights, respect, and a contract, which is one of the central demands of students and has been from the day they left the factory. If they think that's going away because they can wait it out a few days and then the students all go home to their home countries and it's a thing of the past, they've got another thing coming. There are students who are around for months, and the most important thing is that what they've sparked here is not just something that is for the benefit of future students and other J-1s around the country. It's about creating deep and powerful connections with local workers, with unemployed folks, anxiously employed folks, and understanding that their situation and the situation these students found themselves in is part of the same fight.
Excellent, excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Stephen Boykevich. He's the Communications Director for the National Guest Worker Alliance. Guestworkeralliance.org is their website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Stephen's name. You know, you brought up at the beginning that these kids paid somewhere between $3,000 and $6,000. They were told they were going to earn money. They probably didn't realize they were going to get screwed over by having massive amounts taken out of their check for key cards and rent and all kinds of stuff. I saw one paycheck, $44 for a week. Ridiculous. What's going to happen to these kids? Because they thought they were going to come here and make their money back and maybe even have some to take back with them. Is there any chance of these kids becoming whole at some point?
Well, that's absolutely. That's also one of the central demands of the campaign. And we know that any one of the companies can make this happen. There's extraordinary amounts of money that have been abstracted, extracted from these students. They are in situations of real economic need. Essentially, the debt that they were working under is a large part of what left them terrified. Folks sometimes say, okay, you're in a bad situation. You didn't know what you were getting into. You're exhausted and bruised and can't imagine another day of this kind of work. Why don't you just turn around and go home?
Well, you're in another country. Good luck on that.
Of course. And a really wonderful answer came from a young Ukrainian woman named Yana, who just today, she was talking to Ukrainian TV, because this is a story that's getting attention all over the world. And she said, look, my family scraped together $3,000 to give me what was supposed to be the chance of a lifetime. If I turn around and leave, number one, I paid for a return ticket I can't change, right? So that's another couple $100 down the drain. Number two, $3,000 in Ukraine is closer to the equivalent of $15,000 in America. And number three, if I turn around and go home, how do I ever look my parents in the eye again?
Good point.
So this is the kind of situation these students were in, and it's a very clear, it's another clear example of why this is a situation in which they have to be made whole.
Yeah, you know, I look at my wife back in the 80s, did the pretty much the same thing. She went and did cultural exchange programs in Germany and in Toledo, Spain. And, you know, when I told her of this, she just could not imagine. And then the questions came up, you know, what would we say, what would Americans say if we sent our children to other countries and this kind of behavior, this kind of corporate greed, this kind of sweatshop situation would happen to our children?
It's a really great question. It's one of the questions I think a lot of people are asking themselves. It's one of the reasons that folks have connected to these students, first of all, on a very deep emotional level. and second of all, have really understood how they're connected, how they're part of the same fight. You know, Rick, we know we're in a time where there's extraordinary political bitterness on all sides. There's extraordinary economic pressures that all Americans are under. And we know that this leads to very volatile and sometimes really unpleasant conversations about anything that's connected to anyone from a foreign country.
Right.
One of the things that's so extraordinary about this story and about the risks that these students took to stand up, not only to stop Hershey's exploitation of student workers, but to stand up for good living wage jobs for Pennsylvania workers, is that it's created a connection, created a way for people to talk and think that's not about those kinds of knee-jerk, volatile reactions. It's actually helping people understand we're part of the same fight.
Yeah, and it's something we talk about here on the program all the time. You know, it's not about being German workers against American workers or American workers against Chinese. We're all workers at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
And it's this kind of cross-border solidarity that I think has to happen before we're going to see a growing, burgeoning middle class, not just here in the U.S., but across the globe.
It's absolutely true, and you said a wonderful thing that has been in my mind and is there and filled every day, every time I hear one of these students speak, every time they're leading an organizing meeting, they're planning the next steps to their strategy. You know, when you said these students at some point, or whether it's September 1st or it's October 30th, when they go home, many of them are starting international relations or journalism or medicine or engineering. Wherever they go, whatever country they're in, they are going to take this experience of solidarity with American workers, a deep understanding of what corporate greed has done to people across the board and across nations, and what organizing can do, how powerful a change it can make, even against pretty extraordinary odds. They're going to take that with them. They're going to take their ties with Americans with them. They're going to take the relationships they've built up among nations with them. And in a small way, at very least, I think we're going to see these students working to change some of the things we're all struggling with right now.
Yeah, you know, I got to be honest. As I was standing there on Wednesday, watching these kids, you know, do what I think was really very courageous, extremely courageous. I can't think of a word beyond that, but really courageous to step forward, stand up and say no more. I kind of wish that the media would have focused on that and given workers in this country, who they don't have to worry about being taken away and disappeared or thrown out of airplanes like in Colombia. They have, you know, the right to organize here. I wish American workers would have seen that.
Well, I think a lot of folks did. What we've seen, the responses that we've felt, the number of folks in central Pennsylvania who have opened their homes to these students is proof that a lot of people did. We have talked from, you know, a whole range of people, some with long histories in organized labor, some who've never been part of a union, some have been unemployed for many years, talk about the inspiration they've taken from the story, the sense of solidarity, the sense of understanding. And over the next couple days, starting tomorrow actually, with a community dinner in Hershey, there are folks around the state who are opening their homes to these students to invite them in to talk about their own struggles, their own hopes, their own dreams, their own connections, their own youth.
Wow.
And understand these student stories a bit more too. And I think there's some pretty powerful connections and conversations that are going to be happening over the next couple of days.
That sounds extremely exciting. Where can people get information on what's going on here in the area locally?
You can find information about that at our website, the address to which you've given. It's guestworkeralliance.org. You can also search Guest Worker Alliance, the National Guest Worker Alliance, on Facebook. We have updates there, including information about those community events. And there's all the contact information for us, for anyone who's looking for extra details. You can find us either through that Facebook site or through guestworkeralliance.org.
And we will make sure we've got links at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Stephen Boykevich, I appreciate the time. A great, I think, a victory. And really, those kids deserve the utmost credit.
Rick, thank you so much for the attention you've paid, the light you've shown on this situation. All of us, the students, appreciate the support and the attention enormously. And like I said, since we're all part of the same fight, I think we're all taking some big steps and having some real victories right now together.
I absolutely agree. Stephen, thanks so much. I appreciate the time. Again, Stephen Boykevich, Communications Director, National Guest Worker Alliance. Guestworkeralliance.org is the website. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a quick break. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Maybe you thought after George W.'s presidency that at least it can't get worse than that. Well, don't look now, but here comes worse. High strutting out of Bush's Texas, shooting from the lip, smugger and stupider than you would think possible, Rick Perry, the slap-happy Texas governor, says he's ready to be president. This guy puts the dumb in dumbfounding. In just his first couple of weeks as a candidate, he has turned prayer into a political spectacle, crowed ceaselessly that he's the rooster who makes the economic sun come up. Flat out lied that federal regulators are coming after farmers' tractors, and declared that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, a Bush appointee, is a traitor who should get beaten up. Worst of all, though, was his flagrant insult to America's military men and women fighting in the brutal Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. In a flabby roundhouse punch thrown at President Obama's lack of military experience, Perry claimed that he would be the soldier's favorite because they had won a commander-in-chief who had, quote, worn the uniform. While it's true that Perry wore the uniform as an Air Force transport pilot, he never got his uniform dirty, much less bloody. He mostly flew around the U.S. and Europe, hauling, as he himself once put it, the colonel's kitty litter. Never went anywhere near a shooting war. Real soldiers have a term for the likes of Perry, who strutted around as a warrior but dodged any encounters with live munitions. They say that the loud-talking governor served in, quote, the chair force. This is Jim Hightower saying, let me put this as bluntly as I can. Rick Perry is a fraud. For him to suggest that he has, quote, done what these men and women in the military are doing is a grotesque insult. That alone says he's not worthy of even being considered for the highest office in our land. Shame on him.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
To the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download it there. Also, if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app and take your program on the go. I'm really taken back by these kids and the courage that they've shown, the willingness to stand up to corporate greed and to say, no, we won't be used, we won't be abused anymore. And it was really, I go back, that Wednesday was something to see, something I wish every working person in this country would see, that, these kids from all around the world, who, like I said, are from places with petty dictators who, if you do that kind of stuff, you could be gone. You could be disappeared. We're talking about having a free trade agreement with Colombia, a place where if you were to do what they did, they may pull the leader off and shoot him in the head in front of you. Send the message. Or take him and throw him out of a plane. Send the message. That's why it's amazing to me that we don't have more people flocking to collective bargaining, flocking to the people, to organizations that bring people together. Just mind-blowing. I think it's maybe we've got it too good sometimes. Anyway. Bill O'Reilly was doing his whole spiel, how we know that, taxes, destroy jobs and regulations kill jobs. And he's going through this whole litany of right-wing talking points, like they're fact. And the reality is you and I would disagree with everything he said. But Ben Stein, who is a conservative economist. If you know anything about Ben Stein, he was the guy who wrote the speech for Nixon that he wasn't resigning. So I think Stein has very, very solid conservative credentials. So when Bill O'Reilly turned to him and said, well, you know, everything I said is absolutely true, you know, what do you think?
All right, Mr. Stein. Now, you know that everything I said in that memo is true, correct?
Absolutely not. I would say almost every part of it is wrong, except for the fact that I think it's better if he's on vacation because he works terribly hard and he deserves a vacation.
So, you know, but what taxes wrong? What can't be? So a little later on in the conversation, Stein chirps in with this, which just caught me completely off guard.
There's no correlation, Mr. O'Reilly, between tax rates on millionaires and people above that level, billionaires, and the growth of the economy.
Business people are going to take less money?
No. We had the highest growth in capital and in productivity and in the economy generally in the 40s, 50s, and 60s when we had much higher taxes than we had now. Higher taxes
but there was tax dodges, correlated with more growth. All right.
So, wait a second. That right-wing frame, low taxes, that means job creation. Stein, a very conservative Republican, saying no correlation whatsoever. In fact, he went so far as to say that, well, listen to this.
There is none. Don't believe it for a second. If you can show it to me, I'll eat your shoe.
All right. No correlation between unemployment and raising taxes on the very wealthy. He said, I'll eat your shoe if you can prove it. You go through this and you go, where are the sane conservatives? What's happened? And I don't understand. I look at Stein as a conservative. We disagree on certain things, but he's not the radicals that have taken over the Republican Party. He's not the complete radical. He's a guy who's saying, hey, look, I love the country. I want to make sure what's best for the country. And he's saying, look, we need to raise taxes on the very wealthy. In fact, a newly released National Association of Business Economics poll just came out and tells a very different tale that was spun by Bill O'Reilly. In fact, they said three-quarters of economists who do forecasting for the private sector say tax revenue should rise as part of the efforts to tame unsustainable budget deficits. Of the 250 business economists, these are the business-friendly economists. These are the people paid by private industry. These are the folks who they're looking out for big business. They're the business friends. Of the 250 that went along with who did the survey, only 19% said tax reform should be done in a revenue-neutral way. 19%. Because that's what the Republicans want. So they're listening to the minority. And the reality is, as pointed out by the majority of these economists, argued that part of our deficit challenge is because we've had such low tax revenue. In fact, revenues are currently at a 60-year low. And what do the Republicans want to do? They want to cut taxes even more, want to slash and burn even more. They want to cut, gut, and punish even more. And this whole thing that, you know, well, Republicans don't want to raise taxes. I'm telling you, Republicans are going to raise taxes. Mark it down on the calendar right now. They are going to raise taxes. They're not going to want you to think they did, but they're going to raise taxes. The question is on who. Taxes have to be raised. Understand that. There's no question about this. Revenue has to come in. But who's going to pay the freight? Is it going to be the millionaires and billionaires, or is it going to be the 46% of the people who pay no federal income tax? Because we keep hearing that, right? There's 46% of the people who pay no federal income tax whatsoever. Let's not forget that they pay, you know, payroll tax on every dime that they earn. Don't let the facts get in your way. But the Republicans are going to raise taxes on the 46% of us who don't earn enough money. And, you know, I look at this one of the guy who's on the Super 12 committee, this Texas Republican, Jeb Hensarling. He said, quote, it's always a net positive to let taxpayers keep more of what they earn. But not all tax relief is created equal for the purposes of helping to get the economy moving again. What does he mean? What's he mean by that? I agree. You know, you keep money in the pockets of that 46% who don't have the revenue, who spend every dime that they take in? I gotta argue that those people, they need that money, man. And by taking that money from them, from the people at the bottom who are working their butt off just to make ends meet, and handing it to the very wealthy, what I would consider a massive redistribution wealth, and a job creator, and a job killer all wrapped up in one, I gotta tell you, I'm not on board with the Republicans on this. And understand, the payroll tax, the Social Security thing, it's going to go back up. The Republicans are going to allow that to go through, and you and I are going to see a tax increase on every dime that we make. For me, I think we solve our problem pretty simple. There's a lot of very easy solves to this. Politically, the wealth class isn't going to let it happen. But this 2% that they've taken off of the workers' contribution to Social Security has put money in people's pocket. It has had a stimulative effect. It has gotten people to be able to pay their bills and to consume a little bit more. But what it's doing is kind of pushing off down the road, maybe creating a Social Security problem. Because you're talking about over 12 months, you're talking something that's going to cost about $120 billion this year alone and another $120 billion next year. So, you know, I agree with Senator Lamar Alexander, the Republican from Tennessee, who says we don't need short-term gestures. We need long-term fundamental changes in our tax structure and regulatory structure that will create jobs that we can rely on, all that nonsense that they love to throw in there. And I agree. We need structural tax change. We need to raise taxes on the very top. And when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this whole tax situation, and they're going after Buffett. With all guns blazing, the radical right is going after him, and we'll come back and talk about that. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So, the wealth class is going after Buffett again. This time, it's former chairman and CEO of American Express, and the current executive committee member of the American Enterprise Institute, one of these really way out radical right-wing think tanks, a guy named Harry Golub. He wrote today in the Wall Street Journal, which again is one of those beautiful arguments. He says, this is my response to Buffett and Obama. And again, you know, he goes into this whole rant saying, I deeply resent that President Obama has decided that I don't need all the money I've not paid in taxes over the years. He said, I also resent that Warren Buffett and others who have created massive wealth for themselves think I'm coddled because they believe I should pay more taxes. Well, I got to be honest with you. You know, this, you're not starting off real well. You're pointing the finger. He says, of my current income this year, I expect to pay 80 to 90%, which I know, sorry, I'm not getting that. You've got some pretty crummy tax attorneys if you're paying 90% of your income, which is pretty sizable. This is a guy who's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm not buying into it, but he goes into this whole screed of, and they're basically just right-wing talking points. It hits on every one of the Republican frames, like almost half of all filers pay no income at all, no taxes at all. Clearly they earn less and should pay less, he says, but they should pay something and have a stake in our government spending their money too. What I find interesting is they don't have money, but it is the Republican frame. And it's the reason I'm saying they're going to raise taxes on you and me. They're going to raise taxes on the half of us who are not making enough money to pay taxes. So if you're struggling right now, take a look at your tax returns from last year. Take a very close look at it. Because, you know, like they're saying, half of the workers in this country don't pay any federal income tax. Now, we all pay payroll tax. We all pay local sales, all of that stuff. We all pay a huge percentage of our income in taxes. And, you know, where I'm in agreement with the T-Twits, I do believe we are taxed enough already. But here's the thing. You and I are paying more as a percentage of our income than this guy, and I don't know where he's coming up with, I'm going to pay 80, 90%. It's nonsense. But then he goes into some of the, you know, the other things. Well, we need to do away with the mortgage interest deduction because that supports the housing industry at the expense of the renters. And we need to get rid of those generous fringe benefits that are not all taxed. So your health care, he wants to tax because, well, you know, you should have to pay tax on that. And I'm going, well, aren't we taxed enough already? I know I am. And again, he goes into tax on regulation. You know, the government's spending our money on programs that don't work. You know, they're spending it on retraining programs. They're spending it on, on wind turbines and solar panels and stuff that I don't think we need. Basically just going on this bizarre rant. And he also goes on to attack workers because you got to do that. If you're a right winger, he throws in, you know, we require that people have to pay above market labor costs. Yeah, because we'd like to have a local, well-trained, highly skilled construction industry. I think it's a good thing. He's angry about trains. He's angry about post offices. He's angry about small airports that generally someone like him would use. He's against a whole bunch of stuff that benefit you and me. And again, this piece of propaganda, and it is a beautiful piece of propaganda. I would suggest you go take a look at it because it is masterfully written. It is focus group tested, think tank approved. It is right there, man. Hits on all the right wing strings, all of the heart wrenching. Yeah, I agree with him. Here's where it goes awry. In this country, we got one in seven people now living in poverty. 25% of our children now live in poverty. Almost half of the kids in this country are this close to falling into poverty. The average family income in this country right now for the bottom 90% of us, that means you, that means everybody listening to this program tonight, the bottom 90% of us is just over $31,000 a year. That's the average income. Now, if you look at the average income in his sphere, where he lives up in that stratosphere up at the top, you're looking at some $27 million each and every year, year after year after year after year. And then, when you get way up to the top, up to the tippy top, where, you know, the creme de la creme, you know, those heavy 400, the elite 400, whose incomes are, you know, almost $230 million a year. You know, those 400 people who hold more wealth than half of the nation combined. You know, those people. We can't tax them. Because 46% of the people pay no taxes. You know, those children. The 25% of the children in this country whose parents don't have any money. They want them to pay more. Almost half of the kids in this country who are on the verge of falling into poverty, let's push them over to make sure that they're in poverty. You know, the argument here, the question here is who controls the wealth? Where is the money? 90% of us, the bottom 90% of us, $31,000 a year average family income. That is nothing compared to the strata that this guy lives in. And yet he's going to go on this right-wing screed, this rant about resenting having to be asked to do more? Really? I mean, is this the thing? And he goes on, well, we need to get rid of the Department of Education, the Department of Energy. We need to get rid of all that stuff. Get rid of all the government. Get rid of, you know, the whole everything. And, you know, you look at the money that we spend on this stuff, like the Department of Education, we spend for fiscal year 2012, somewhere around $77 billion for the entire program. The entire budget of the Department of Energy is somewhere around $30 billion. Obama's rail plan, that he $8 billion. You know, you're talking about pennies compared to the federal budget deficit of somewhere around $1.4 trillion. And why is that? A big portion of it is because we had to hand out the Bush tax handouts. We had to continue that so that people like him could continue to stuff his pockets and create jobs elsewhere. And I keep going back to the fact that, look, at the end of the day, those with the largest shoulders, those with the broadest shoulders should be the ones asked to carry more of the weight. And that's all Buffett's saying. He's going, look, it was because we had infrastructure, it was because of government spending, it was because of government investment, research and development, a transportation system, a stability in the banking system, stability with currency, stability across the board that they were able to make their billions. And now that they've made their billions, they want to walk away. And I guess that is the Republican way. That is the right-wing way. You make your short term, hooray for me, screw you dollar, and you turn your back on everybody else. And I got to tell you, I'm not there. You know, when you look at the numbers, yeah, the very wealthy are paying a lot in taxes. But when you look at the reality that they have taken almost the entire pie for themselves, shouldn't they? Or am I wrong? Somehow that the income disparity in this country has grown so wide because they have done such a masterful job of the money that they redistributed from us to them to convince us that, well, you don't need labor unions, you don't need to organize, you don't need collective bargaining to fight for better wages and hours and conditions, and those people who have it, we need to go after them. I mean, really stop and think about how insane that argument is. This whole right-wing screed about public sector employees, they make too much money. Because I'm not making enough. Instead of going, well, how do I make more like they do? Oh, yeah, they belong to a union. They actually bargained for their wages. So what's the right wing in this country do? Let's steal that right away. I can't have that. Because those other worker bees, those other people at the bottom, they may get a thought in their head. And heaven forbid that happen, because then we might have to share. You know, I'd have to share some of the pie. Then we won't have as much money to spend on right-wing think tanks who come up with great pieces of propaganda, focus group tested, think tank approved pieces of garbage like this guy wrote here today. But again, some working people are going to buy into this. And that, my friends, is what's scary. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you
listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The battle continues, and we must stay united until we get a fair contract. I want to thank all of my union brothers and sisters, both from landline and the wireless side, for their support in this fight. This is a true David and Goliath story being played out right now. David will once again win.
CWA Local 1101's Danny Gutierrez on the Verizon strike ending today. Striking Verizon workers return to work today under indefinite extensions of their existing collective bargaining agreements. Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says the unity that striking CWA and IBEW workers demonstrated in their two-week strike will continue, along with continued union mobilization, until a new collective bargaining agreement is won at Verizon.
That will go on, not only until we have a decent contract, but until working people feel like they can join a union, any union, and bargain with their head held high across this country. We should return united as much as we can, marching in together, literally, at the start of a shift. For now, our unity will be to support the bargaining team and to show it. But if that process doesn't work in the weeks ahead, management absolutely knows that that unity will again be directed at them.
Cohen says the unions and working Americans everywhere need to build a new democracy movement to battle corporate power's assault on the middle class. Miles Calvi is IBEW Local 2222 business manager.
In good faith, we've decided to have our members go back and see if we can at least change the process. The process up to this point has been 100% concessionary, and as we explained to the company, even if we were crazy enough to come to a tentative agreement, it would never be accepted by the membership, so it was a complete waste of time.
He says a company like Verizon, with more than $106 billion a year in revenue, can't just dump health care costs on the backs of workers.
What a corporation that brings in $107 billion a year and has operating income profits of over $3 billion, if they decide that they're not going to help out on the health care issues, then we are in serious trouble.
Calvi says as Verizon workers get back to work and collective bargaining resumes, the public can help the unions build a democracy movement that defends the dream of a strong American middle class.
Any communication they have with Verizon, just tell them how outrageous it was, that it wasn't just an attack on their employees, it's an attack on the middle class in this country.
The AFL-CIO is submitting more than 21,000 public comments from workers who want to see new NLRB union election rules adopted. The proposed rules would speed up union elections and help ensure that workers who want to vote to have a union have a fair choice. The AFL-CIO says working people overwhelmingly support the new NLRB election standards, despite a torrent of politically motivated attacks on the rules from companies and anti-union organizations. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Absolute truth. The working class is absolutely under attack. You see it across the country every day. And I got to be honest, the time is now. We need to be like those J-1 visa kids over at Hershey who said, no more. We're not taking it anymore. We need to stand up and fight back. Today in labor history, 1927 was the year. Italian immigrant Nicolai Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were accused of murder and tried unfairly. Today, they were executed. The case became an international cause and sparked demonstrations throughout the world. Yet, turns out they didn't do it. Here again. Scary stuff. Anyway, what we're seeing across the country, starving unions and destroying their ability to fight corporate greed and the billionaire petty dictators who control our politicians, need somebody to fight back. That's why we've asked Mark Anderson. He is a writer over at Daily Kos Labor to come talk to us about what's going on there in Wisconsin. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks. for having me on.
I appreciate it. You know, I'm looking at your piece, Another Union Falls in Wisconsin, and again, what you're seeing is this attack on workers, especially teachers and public sector workers across the country. Tell me what happened.
Well, there's one post that was out there before that about WEAC, the largest teachers union in Wisconsin. And last week, they had to lay off 42 employees from the union because union dues aren't coming in, because they're no longer being taken out of the employees' paychecks, plus a lot of contracts are gone now. So there is no bargaining unit. There's no income coming into the union. That was followed by, on Friday, the teaching assistants union at UW-Madison held a vote to recertify the union because part of this new budget repair bill that our wonderful governor passed has a requirement in it that all public employee unions, in order to stay in existence, have to recertify every year, which I don't quite understand the reasoning behind it other than to just get rid of the union.
Well, that's the reason. There's no other reason. This is Machiavellian politics at its finest. This is Walker taking, his enemy out in the public and gutting him in public. That's all right. This is. This has nothing to do with the state of Wisconsin. It has nothing to do with the budget. It has everything about taking out your political enemy.
Right. And what happened was the Teachers Assistance Union voted. Well, it's a very close vote. I don't know the exact numbers other than it was very close. They voted not to recertify the union. They are hoping that the graduate assistants and teaching assistants will continue to pay their union dues so they can keep up some of their work. I'm not sure how they're going to be able to work for workplace safety or better hours or better pay, because no one's going to listen to them at the state level anymore.
Well, I mean, they're not going to have the ability to do anything, and that's really the point. And in Wisconsin, that's what the right wing is looking at to hope to do across this country by stealing the ability of workers and their representatives to have any say in what happens on the job or in politics.
Right, right. And the sad thing is, I was actually a graduate assistant on another campus last year, and just to give you an example of how things are changing. The campus I was at was non-union, so there was no union for me to join.
Right.
But in Madison, there is a union for the TAs, and their union dues, depending if you're full-time, part-time, and what your duties are, vary between $12 and $28 a month. And I shared a lot of the benefits that union got, because it made me a state employee, it gave me quite a few benefits.
Yeah, I mean, it raised the floor up so that you wouldn't maybe see the organizing go on where you're at.
Right.
I understand it.
Right, and now one of the things that sticks out the most to me is my health plan. I was on the state of if I had not had a full time job, I could have opted to go on to the state of Wisconsin's health plan that graduate assistants get, $15 a month, which when your pay is only $800 a month, that's pretty darn reasonable.
Right.
That same plan is to be $42 a month starting actually tomorrow, I believe. Tomorrow or the next day.
Well, we gotta get money from people who have it. You guys got jobs, $800 a month. There's a lot there.
Yeah, and these guys are actually the ones that are doing the teaching, that are doing the research. They're the ones that are making, the University of Wisconsin what it is. They're making it, so that students can go there and they can actually get it, have a class where they can get a lecture. They're the ones that are doing all the research that's bringing in all the money to the school. And they get paid between, if you're part-time like I was, $800 a month to a whopping $1,600 a month if you're full-time.
Help me here. You said a second ago that the University of Wisconsin-Madison TAs voted narrowly against recertifying the union there. Help, as I understand it, the law change that went in is much like what happened with the Rail Act and what Delta's fighting against with the FAA bill, that all votes that are not cast are considered no votes. Is that the case in this situation?
My understanding is that is the case in this situation.
So is there any do we have any sense of how many people didn't vote? I mean, is this a situation where 49% of the people voted and 100% of them wanted it and 51% of the people didn't vote? So you lost?
Well, I have not seen any numbers on that yet. I would have to say that probably quite a few people did not vote, just for the simple fact school is not in session yet.
Right.
The students really are actually, they start arriving this week. So it is very possible that there are a large number of students that did not vote.
Yeah, and I look at this, and I got to be honest with you, Mark. The more you see these attacks going on, and there's a part of me that says maybe we need this. Maybe we need a good kick in the backside. Maybe we need a good punch in the gut to wake us up. And you know, and I thought we had that, but maybe we need the real big blow.
You know, it's still, I still hear from the people on the right that live, the few people that are on the right that live here in Madison, that they think getting rid of these unions is the greatest thing in the world. It's going to make our state so much more efficient. And I just can't, I just don't see that. And it's, and I am seeing now since the recall elections have ended, you're seeing some of the energy that we had kind of going down. And maybe you're right. Maybe this will be that kick in the pants when we start seeing union after union go down.
I mean, because there's part of me that goes, you know, maybe we need to follow some of the right-wing ideas. And when it collapses and we have mass suffering, as we did after the Great Depression, then maybe our heads get right. You know, the old labor saying, when your stomach's empty, your head gets right. Maybe we haven't fallen far enough. Maybe we've bought too much into this radical right-wing idea of the benevolent corporation and the benevolent dictator, if you will.
Right. Oh, I agree completely. And, you know, maybe these people who just haven't been hit over the head hard enough with it.
Because I can't imagine, you know, everybody I talk to, they give me the same line. Oh, I'm just grateful to have a job. Yeah, they took wages, they took benefits. I'm paying more for my health care. They've frozen my pension. I hear these stories every day, constantly. And you see the reports from Wall Street, like the Jay guy from J.P. Morgan Chase, who said, you know, profits for the big corporations are better than they've been since the 60s. And the reason that they're so good is we've been able to steal wages and benefits back. And I just can't imagine people going, yeah, that's the kind of world I want to live in.
Yeah, my brother actually was the lead carpenter in a local school district here. He actually ended up retiring because he would make more money on retirement and working part time than he would have had he stayed in a job he loved, making his union wages because of the cuts.
And you know, the question I have for people is, how little should workers make? I mean, how little of a wage should we make? We keep hearing people say, like I just talked about this Harry Gulub guy who wrote the piece attacking Buffett, you know, going, we shouldn't have to pay above market wages. Well, what are market wages? How low do they have to get before they meet an acceptable level?
Yeah, a friend of mine is a I hate to use the term friend, is a right-wing Republican. And I also have another very close friend who is unemployed right now. And we were talking a couple days ago, and the Republican friend said, well, you know, an $8 an hour job is better than no job at all. Well, my unemployed friend came back to him and said, well, how am I supposed to continue my house payment? How am I supposed to pay all my bills that I still have? I didn't ask to have my company up and move. How am I supposed to put my son into daycare on $8 an hour? He said, it's at least $13 an hour just to stay afloat.
Well, the answer is they don't care.
And he flat out, and, you know, he could not answer him at that point. But I think you're right. They don't care. They want to get the lowest wages possible so that way they can force you to stay in a lousy job and you have no choice to go anywhere else.
But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's about the me. We've become consumers. And you know, I had this mentality that I'm a worker first. It's about kitchen table economics. It's about how much money I'm bringing in. And then I'm a consumer. But the masterful thing that's happened in this country is we've turned everyone into consumers. We're thinking about, oh, well, he's making more than I am, so we should tear that down. And I got to tell you, I think it's a very dangerous path we're hoeing.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. It actually frightens me to see the path we're on. You know, I look at, you know, my son's future, and I'm terrified. I don't know how I'm going to be able to pay for college for him. You know, I certainly don't want him to have to go through the path I went, you know, which was having to go into the military to do it. You know, I'm very worried about his future.
You know, I look at the fact that 400 people, 400, that's enough. I think we could probably fit 400 people into our studio, maybe a little bit bigger space than we need, maybe a little bigger, 400 people. They control as much wealth as half of this nation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're not telling me we've got a problem with wealth distribution? And all I hear from my teetotaler friends, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. You're damn right I am. I want to distribute it back to me where it was taken away.
My friend, again, going back to my Republican friend, we had the same discussion today. And he seems to think that wealth creates jobs. Wealth does not create jobs. His example was that Bill Gates and his wealth created all those jobs at Microsoft.
No, it didn't.
The problem is Bill Gates didn't have that wealth when he started Microsoft.
No, me wanting to buy Microsoft's product, that created his wealth.
Right. And what actually created that wealth for him was the people who actually built the product that he was pushing out the door. Without them, that product would have never left the store, would have never gotten out of the Microsoft offices, it would have never been written, it would have never gone out the door, and you would have never bought it. But, and that's where the disconnect is. Yep. Labor creates capital, not capital creates labor.
I think there was a president who said something like that.
I think there was.
I think he was a Republican, too.
Yeah, he was a pretty good one, as I recall.
I think he was the first one. But here again, you know, that there's a disconnect in the party. Like today, you know, Ben Stein, I don't know if you heard the Ben Stein clip, but, you know, O'Reilly's talking about all these right-wing talking points and how, you know, the economy is, we need to cut taxes to create jobs and we need to do all these right-wing things. And here's the clip.
All right, Mr. Stein. Now, you know that everything I said in that memo is true, correct?
Absolutely not. I would say almost every part of it is wrong, except for the fact that I think it's better if he's on vacation.
And, you know, he, finally, a conservative Republican who's saying, you know, all of your talking points are wrong. We need to raise taxes on rich people. We need to bring in more revenue to fund the government. We need to do these things. And I look at Stein, who I view as a very conservative Republican, as the standard that should be and how far the Republican Party has veered from him.
Right. I think part of the problem is that the Republican Party has gone from a party that used to care about the country to a party that only cares about the party.
And
they no longer care about what happens to the United States of America. They only care about what happens to the Republican Party.
That's an excellent point, and how they fill their campaign coffers, which is another reason why we need to get money out of politics.
Oh, exactly. I firmly believe we need to have federally funded elections and all the way down to the local level. I mean, a guy like me, I could never afford to run for office if I wanted to.
Yeah, I don't want to. I don't need that headache.
If I wanted to run for, you know, state assembly, state senate, whatever, I would not have the funds to do that. I mean, I cannot quit my job and make my house payment to do that. And I don't think any normal person can.
And that's why we end up with the wealth class running everything and how we end up with policies that benefit them. Scary, scary stuff. The piece is Another Union Falls in Wisconsin, written by Mark Anderson. DailyCos.labor.org is the website. We've got a link at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mark Anderson's name. Mark, great talking with you. Look forward to having you again real soon.
Yep. Bye.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Maybe you thought after George W.'s presidency that at least it can't get worse than that. Well, don't look now, but here comes worse. High strutting out of Bush's Texas, shooting from the lip, smugger and stupider than you would think possible, Rick Perry, the slap-happy Texas governor, says he's ready to be president. This guy puts the dumb in dumbfounding. In just his first couple of weeks as a candidate, he has turned prayer into a political spectacle, crowed ceaselessly that he's the rooster who makes the economic sun come up, flat out lied that federal regulators are coming after farmers' tractors, and declared that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, a Bush appointee, is a traitor who should get beaten up. Worst of all, though, was his flagrant insult to America's military men and women fighting in the brutal Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. in a flabby roundhouse punch thrown at President Obama's lack of military experience, Perry claimed that he would be the soldiers' favorite because they had won a commander-in-chief who had, quote, worn the uniform. While it's true that Perry wore the uniform as an Air Force transport pilot, he never got his uniform dirty, much less bloody. He mostly flew around the U.S. and Europe, hauling, as he himself once put it, the colonel's kitty litter. Never went anywhere near a shooting war. Real soldiers have a term for the likes of Perry, who strutted around as a warrior but dodged any encounters with live munitions. They say that the loud-talking governor served in, quote, the chair force. This is Jim Hightower saying, let me put this as bluntly as I can. Rick Perry is a fraud. For him to suggest that he has, quote, done what these men and women in the military are doing is a grotesque insult. That alone says he's not worthy of even being considered for the highest office in our land. Shame on him.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Well, it looks like enrollment for the for-profit colleges seems to be going down over or plunged in recent months, the report at the Wall Street Journal says, by more than 45%. As the empty promises of these subprime schools come to light to potential students, the colleges have pulled back on aggressive recruiting practices amid criticism over the high student loan default rates, according to the Wall Street Journal. They also write that many would-be students are questioning the potential payoff for degrees that can cost considerably more than what's available at local community colleges. The Washington Post reports, Kaplan reports, enrollment down 47%, while large for-profit operator Carthion College Incorporated stocks sank to an 11-year low. The schools that receive millions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies from student loans, but are often delivering a substandard education. For these reasons, the Justice Department has joined a lawsuit against the for-profit education industry. So, you know, you see all of those on TV, and I see them all the time. You know, we're here for you, special responders, and, you know, all of this online stuff. You know, and look, I bought in partially to it. You know, at the end of the day, it is convenient. It is, you know, something that, you know, it's easy to fall into. But you look at how much it costs and the payback that you get out of it and the money that's gone into this, that you and I are paying to these for-profit universities that pay their CEOs mega bucks, they pay out shareholders, but that's part of conservative world. And you look at the story today that, you know, points out that between 1999 and the beginning of 2011, you have seen the student debt, the debt held by kids balloon 511% over that, you know, just a little bit better than a decade. In 1999, student debt was about $90 billion. First quarter of 2011, that balance was over $550 billion in outstanding federal student loans. And there's a major, not just a bubble, they're calling it a balloon. They're calling this a real problem. The National Post-Secondary Student Aid Study for 1999-2000 school year reported that $3.6 billion of debt was through private student loans. Just 10 years later, you look at the private educational debt that's been taken on, over $405 billion. So you add that together, what the government has, with the private market has, you're talking almost $1 trillion in outstanding student loans. And, you know, these people who get there, who go to these private institutions, you're seeing student loan rate defaulting at a pretty high rate. And what happens What happens when kids don't graduate? What happens when you have this debt hanging over your head? And more you're seeing, I forget what the numbers is, and somewhere around half, maybe half of the kids who start college actually finish it. Some 45%, something like that, some outrageous number, because they run out of money. And I remember when I was in school, the first time I went, I ran out of money. And then it became this situation where I had time and no money and money and money and no time. So again, you stop and you think about it. What does education mean? And I look at this report that just came out, the high cost of low graduation rates, by the American Institutes for Research. They're saying what's dropping out of college really cost? And they've gone through and they looked at the kids who started college in the fall of 2002. And they said, look, you got these kids who are seeking a bachelor's degree. What happens if they don't graduate? And they look 6 years later, and they've approximated that there's about $3.8 billion in lost income for those kids alone, which equates to some $566 million in lost federal income. So you're not getting that income tax. The state income tax is down $164 million because, again, there isn't all this money coming in. California, for example, they looked at them and said the college dropout problem is costing them nearly $15 billion over the work lives of these kids and costing the federal government some $3 billion in lost income. In Texas, New York, same thing. Here in Pennsylvania, same thing. Like I said, I remember. I remember myself going to school and trying to figure out how to take out loans, trying to figure out how to be able to afford it. If you can do the work, shouldn't we be, as a society, making sure that our kids have that opportunity? Do we not want to compete? And I go back to that Friedman article I read the other day, who said, well, we need to have more college graduates, we need to study harder, we need to do more. Okay, if you buy that premise, if you buy the premise that we need to have smarter people, more educated people, why are we kicking them out of school? Because they can't afford it. Don't we as a nation have a policy that says, you know what? We want to be able to compete with every country around the world. And if you can do the level of work, it is paid for. Instead of going to this for-profit industry where, hey, some shyster can then come out and figure out a way of ripping you off. Do we really value education? Or is it just another industry? Do we really value education? Or is it just something we talk about? Is another mode of profit? Is another campaign contribution? Is it another TV commercial? Is it another newspaper commercial? Is another stream for me to make a couple of bucks? I wish we did believe in education, and I wish as Thomas Jefferson, who started the Virginia University there, free. Kids can go there if you can do the work. You can go there. What's it say about us that we have this massive debt? You're talking about $1 trillion, almost $1 trillion in outstanding student loans. And the thing about the federal student loans, you never get out from under those. It's like herpes. You don't get rid of them. If you can't pay them, they're going to follow you to the grave. So that these private for-profit universities, they can make their buck. And even the big universities, the schools, they can make their buck. We've turned it into an industry for profit, not an industry for creating thinkers and problem solvers and inventors and the leaders of tomorrow. I'm distraught over the state of education because we've got people in this country, we need to cut taxes for people like Gallup. We need to cut taxes for the Koch brothers. In fact, what we need to do is we need to let the Koch brothers fund education, like they did down in Florida. See, you give them a couple $1 million, and then the Koch brothers can have a say on who teaches economics in the university. And I'm not making this up. They gave $2 million. Here's our donation, but we want to have final say on all economics professors being hired. because we want to make sure that they buy our free market ideology, which is why I have 23-year-old kids calling into here telling, well, we need a service-based economy. We need to be more service-based. We don't need that dirty manufacturing. We don't need to make anything. We just need to go full tilt boogie at cutting grass and washing windows and washing animals and cutting hair and doing all those service jobs that are such high-paying jobs. That's what we need to do. Scary, scary stuff. And that's what you get when you have the wealth class dictating what's taught in your economics classes. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
And I haven't got a penny, but I buy no more whiskey. I have to go home. Brother, my cup is empty.
If I listen to that song much longer, I'm going to need my own whiskey. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Well, the Bank of America Death Watch is on. And no wonder. You look at what Bank of America said that today was a mistake. Evidently, it foreclosed on a retired Florida man who is bedridden with a terminal illness and his wife, who is his sole caregiver. And yes, why did Bank of America foreclose on this terminally ill man? Turns out the couple made their mortgage payment a week early. I'm not making this up. The elderly couple will be to return to their loan modification plan, and the Florida and the foreclosure proceedings will be halted, according to the St. Petersburg Times. So, like I said, it appears that the death spiral may be coming on, as some are saying. And the question is Bank of America too big to fail or too far gone to save? And really, do we want to save it, given its past? Here to help us go through some of this is Sarah Jaffe. She has written a piece over at alternet.org titled, Is Bank of America Headed Towards Collapse? Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, sure. No problem. Thanks for having me.
So what's the latest here in the death spiral report?
Doom, doom, and more doom. The latest in the debt spiral is that it's a, sort of a wonky term, but the credit default swaps against Bank of America, basically Wall Street betting that Bank of America is going to collapse, are the last I saw this morning at higher levels than Lehman Brothers before they died.
Wow. So the big money, the big money is betting against them.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when the big money bets against you, when the investor class bets against you, there's probably not much hope.
Yeah, something like that.
So when what kind of timetable are we looking at, and what do you expect to happen?
I don't really know what I expect to happen because under the Dodd-Frank bill law, we're not supposed to have any more bailouts.
Right.
And we've also got the Tea Party Congress that, you know, the number one thing that they were all so angry about was the bank bailouts. So I don't know if there is, you know, political will or the possibility for another big bailout. But also, talk about too big to fail. Bank of America's only gotten bigger since 2008. They bought Countrywide, and they bought all those bad mortgages that are the thing that's bringing them down. So.
Yeah. And you know, you look at the, you know, you look at what we just found out this weekend that that the Feds gave out some $1.2 trillion in basically interest free loans to people like Bank of America.
Yep.
And the housing situation's still in the really in the toilet. And yeah. I took the position right from the start. What we should have done from the very beginning is nothing with Bank of America, nothing with the banks. Make the people at the bottom whole. And it would trickled its way up. This way, you know, those millions of people who were foreclosed on, maybe they'd still be in their homes.
Oh yeah, and it's not just people who are foreclosed on. It's people who are underwater in their mortgages now because their, you know, the housing wealth was wiped out by the collapse of the housing bubble. So, you know, you bought a house back in sometime in the 2000s when the, you know, the value of your house was pumped up really high because the banks were selling mortgage-backed securities based on your home loan. And now your house isn't worth half what it was worth. You paid way too much for it. You got it, you know, I have a friend who's trying to sell her house who can't get out from under this loan because, you know, even to take a loss on it, they can't afford to take a loss on it.
But here's the thing you're missing, Sarah. You're missing the point. You know, the right-wing frame, and you got to love a good frame. I wholeheartedly disagree with it, but it is what they're saying. They're saying it was those minorities. It was the poor minorities who got loans they didn't deserve. They're the ones. It was the Community Reinvestment Act. That's what brought our massive economy to its knees.
Well, you know, it's really, really easy to blame all those people, but who wrote them the loans? Who made the loans? Who are all these super smart people who need to get their big fat bank bonuses?
Well, yeah, but here again, this is another example, and we're still talking about deregulating. We still hear the same people spewing the same garbage. We need to deregulate. The reason things didn't go right is we didn't deregulate enough. And I look at the banking industry, sorry, I don't want my bank being a gambling casino, and that's what we saw.
Yeah, and that's what we still see, because Bank of America hasn't made any changes. You know, they really have not made any significant changes to the way they do business since back before, you know, meltdown and, like you pointed out, many, many millions of dollars in Fed loans, as well as the actual TARP money.
You know, as I remember, when they gobbled up Countrywide,
right.
I kind of remembered at the time that they really thought they were going to be able to profit from this by, you know, redoing a lot of these mortgages and then charging fees galore. Hasn't happened.
No, it really hasn't happened. They really have not modified many of the mortgages at all. And meanwhile, they're getting sued over Countrywide. AIG, which, you know, everybody knows AIG is the company that brought down, you know, helped bring down the economy. But we still basically own AIG. So AIG suing Bank of America, it's not really like the Justice Department doing its job, but it's somebody at least trying to hold Bank of America and Countrywide accountable for what they did.
Yeah, it's a little shell game. But, you know, in bringing that up, can you explain a little bit what New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's role in all of this is? And did you see today they're being removed from the group of state's attorney generals?
I did, yeah. So Eric Schneiderman is the New York Attorney General, so he's the Attorney General for the state that has Wall Street. Also, other than that, he's just actually taking, you know, his job seriously, doing what he's supposed to do, which is basically saying, I'm not going to sign on to any settlement that preempts my ability to bring charges or to further investigate any of this stuff, which is what the settlement that they're trying to hash out would do. It would basically take a bunch of money once and for all that supposedly makes, as you mentioned, the people at the bottom whole, but actually gives them immunity on anything else. So Schneiderman, and also Beau Biden, who is, yes, the vice president's son, is the attorney general of Delaware. They are actually trying to not sign away their right to prosecute, basically.
Yeah, because I got to be honest, and when I look at this, you know, this guy being taken off of this group kind of tells me the fix is already in. They're just trying to, you know, smooth the way forward so that the banks survive and people like you and me end up holding the bag.
Yeah, well, the fix is definitely, if not entirely in, there's, you know, Schneiderman's been getting pressure from the Justice Department. He's been getting, you know, sneered in the media. This woman who is on the board of the New York Fed is all over the place saying, you know, I think the comment was Wall Street is our main street here in New York, which I don't know about that. I live in New York, and my main street doesn't look a whole lot like Wall Street.
No.
My main street didn't get plowed for, you know, a week and a half this winter when we had massive snowstorms, and I'm pretty sure that Wall Street was back in functioning.
Yeah, they make sure that things are taken care of there. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Sarah Jaffe. She's written a great piece over at alternet.org. Is Bank of America headed towards collapse? We've also got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Sarah's name. It'll take you right there. You know, in going forward, if this does go down, if Bank of America does collapse, and, you know, the U.S. government does nothing, what happens to all of those mortgages? What's going to happen to all those people who are kind of in limbo with their foreclosures and with their, you know, their modifications and all that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think we have a blueprint for what this would look like, right? We haven't seen this before because this is why they jumped in and bailed everybody out, right? Yeah. They said it's too big to fail. I mean, the thing that, like I said before, I mentioned Lehman Brothers, right? Lehman Brothers went down, and that rocked the economy, rocked the stock market, and scared them into bailing out everything else.
So, you know, because there's part of me that goes, yeah, they're too big to fail. And just like you said, if they do to go down, it could take everything with it. But if we don't let them go down, what signal does that tell the rest of the big banking industry, which I think we should have broke up from day one?
Oh, yeah.
And broken into smaller banks, regional, district banks, whatever you want to call them, instead of allowing them to get bigger, bigger, and bigger like Bank of America has.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that, you know, people like to say, or the right wing likes to say, that it was the fault of the borrowers, and we can't take care of those borrowers and make them whole or write down their mortgages because of the moral hazard. Well, let's talk about the moral hazard of, you know, bailing out Bank of America again.
Yep. You know, we do have a blueprint, though, and it was one that I had talked about right from the very beginning, the day this whole thing happened.
Yeah.
The Home Ownership Loan Corporation under FDR, they bought up all of the mortgages, and over the length of the time, they did turn a very small profit, but they stopped the foreclosure crisis, and they began to stabilize the housing market back then, which is something I thought we should have done right from the beginning here. But I think the people, the heisters, the big banksters, they were just more interested in filling their own pockets.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. I mean, there's, you know, again, I was talking to another person that I know today who has a mortgage with Countrywide and is trying desperately to get one of these, you know, the voluntary write-down that is the only thing that has been, you know, that's the only option you have, is basically going and begging Bank of America to, you know, write down your mortgage. They haven't been doing that. They've been, you know, helping out a handful of people. There's not a lot of options, and, you know, we're still basically stuck waiting for the goodwill of these people who have certainly not shown a lot of it so far.
Yeah, well, you know, at the end of the day, like I said from the beginning, we should have made the bottom whole. That always seems to take care of the top, because the top, they're going to have theirs. Folks at the bottom who are struggling, the people who have been ripped off. And I've been saying this, most of the people I've met, and maybe you can check with your friend about this, most of the people who I've met who've been foreclosed on and end up losing their home are people who were in their house about 5 years. And anybody who knows anything about a mortgage knows that those first 5 years are the vast majority of your payment is interest. You build no equity. And I'm saying this is a huge ripoff of wealth from the working class to these banksters. Because I think they did this, there's a part of me, and it's the very cynical part of me, that says, you know, they did this on purpose.
You don't get a lot of argument from me on that one.
Again, the piece is Bank of America Headed Towards Collapse, written by Sarah Jaffe, alternet.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Sarah, great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. A sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make that thing happen!
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alert.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn was in Oklahoma last week where he was talking to some of his constituents at a town hall, one of the few people out there doing that, evidently. And he was asked by one of the town hall goers if he believed Obama wants to destroy the United States. He wants to kill the country, doesn't he? He hates America. Hates it. Well, Coburn had an interesting answer. And here it is. He said, no, I don't. His intent isn't to destroy, it's to create dependency, because it works so well for him. Coburn said, I don't say that critically. Look at people for what they are. Don't assume ulterior motives. I don't think he doesn't love our country. I think he does. There's a compliment. He said, as an African-American male coming through the progress of everything he experienced, he got tremendous benefit through a lot of these programs. So he believes in them. Coburn says, I just don't believe they work overall, and in the long run, they don't help our country. So Coburn goes on to say, but he doesn't know that because his life experience is something different. So it's very important not to get mad at the man and understand his philosophy. There's nothing wrong with his philosophy other than it's goofy and wrong. but that doesn't make him a bad person. Now, I got to give Coburn credit. The right-wing frame would be, he's a maniac and he's a lunatic. He hates the country and he wants to steal our money and give it to those poor black people like him. He didn't do that, so I give him credit for that. But this frame created a culture of dependency. You remember Newt Gingrich saying, "Oh, the Democrats, they're the food stamp party." Because, you know, the times are tough and we needed to help feed people. You know, heaven forbid that we allow them to starve, as I think Newt would have let them. But, you know, you look at all this and when you hear him say it, well, yeah, Obama, he benefited from all that stuff. Yes. And I'm not really sure what he's talking about, to be honest with you. Obama was raised in a middle class environment. His mother and his grandparents, pretty solid middle class. I don't believe he had this government dependency. He went to some of the finest private schools in the country and then on to the Ivy League. So I'm not getting this government dependency thing Colbert's talking about. And I know some people think, and I've gotten this from people in the past, well, you know, Obama and his mother, they were on welfare. That's not true. There's nowhere where you can find that other than in some right-wing crank sites that throw that out there with no evidence. And then there's some people say, well, you know, he got money from somehow, from the government. You know, when his father died, maybe he got there. Well, here's the thing. When Obama's father died, he didn't get survivor benefits from Social Security. Obviously, his father didn't really work here, so he didn't qualify. Yet, strangely enough, and I find this ironic, Republican Paul Ryan, whose father died of a heart attack when he was 16, did collect survivor benefits from Social Security. And what I find even more interesting and kind of odd is Obama, who didn't get anything from the program, he wants to keep the program for my children in case something happens to me. While Paul Ryan, who benefited from it, wants to ditch the program. I mean, do you see the hypocritical nature here? I mean, when I was a kid, my mother passed away when I was 13. And my grandparents took me in. They needed that survivor benefit to take care of me. And it was only a couple $100 a month. But it was enough to make sure that I had clothes, to make sure that there was food, to make sure that it didn't hurt them. And it's smart policy. You know, I'm the sole breadwinner in my house. Now, I've got life insurance and we've got other things. But if I were to die tomorrow, my wife would probably have a very hard time if it weren't for our insurance and stuff that we've got planned, but also for Social Security benefits for our children. And I actually take that into consideration at a certain point. If something were to happen, my kids will be taken care of until they're 18. That's a smart policy. That's the part of the social safety net that helps us all. Do we want to go back to the 1890s? Do we want to go back to the 90s? Where if you're the breadwinner was killed in the coal mine, they took the body and threw it at the house and say, oh, by the way, as soon as the body cools, you guys are out of the company house. And oh, by the way, you got to pay the company store. And oh, by the way, you're going to have to pay for his funeral and everything that goes along with it. Do we want to go back to those days? Is that what we're saying? So all this talk of destroying Social Security, to me, you want to destroy those programs. And I saw this article in the Associated Press. The headline reads, Social Security Disability on the Verge of Insolvency. So you read down through the article and you say, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of people going on it. You know, economic times are bad. You know, a lot of older people can't find jobs. You know, they've got these ailments they're going toward. And you get down to this part where it says, if Congress does not act, the disability program will collect only enough payroll taxes to pay about 85% of the benefits after the trust fund is exhausted in 2017. Well, I read the headline. The headline says, on the verge of insolvency. Most people think broke. No more money. It all stops. But you read down, you know, about halfway into the article, and, well, it'll pay 85%, you know, on into the future. And then they go on to say that the combined retirement, you know, the what people get when they turn 65 or 67 or 70 or wherever it goes from here, and the disability trust fund are projected to run out of money in 2036. I've seen 2037. We've seen a bunch of numbers. And we can fix that. Pretty simple. oh my God, it's going to run out of money. No, the fund's not going to run out of money, but it's going to pay a lesser benefit. And they're saying about 3/4. But the way it's spun out there is, well, the whole program's going to collapse right out from under our feet. That's the end of it. Everyone starves. There's chaos. And that's what they want you to believe. The system is not broken. The system needs a little tweaking. And Social Security is fine. In fact, you know, I saw a report the other day that said, you know, there's going to be a surplus in Social Security of about $22 trillion down the road. We're fine. But it's all this histrionics. It's all of this, oh, we got to do something. Oh, we need to cut. So that we get used to the idea of, oh, well, you know, we shouldn't have these benefits. We shouldn't plan on having some retirement when we get older. And a big problem with Social Security, with this disability thing, as they pointed out in the article, is that the economy's in the crapper. You've got, and they're expecting some 3.3 million people to apply for disability benefits, which they're saying is 700,000 more than in 2008 and a million more than a decade ago. So you're looking at this and you're going, if the economy turns around, we get people back to work, maybe this changes. And then you don't have the problem. That's the thing when you start taking hard numbers with Social Security. It changes every year just a little bit. And there's a lot of moving parts in this, but they want you to believe, man, the end of the world's coming. We need to scrap it, and you need to get yours. You need to scrap the whole program. Back with those other people, go get yours, because there'll be nothing left. That's what they want you to believe. And they keep us separated. Because, oh, you're going to take something that's mine. Oh, I'm not going to give up. That's mine. But at some point, you have to see past this. And you have to start looking below the surface. And like, you know, any con, don't pay attention to what they're showing you. You know, what they're sticking in your face is the shiny thing. That's the distraction. It's everything else that you have to worry about. And this whole talk about Medicare, oh, they're going to destroy Medicare. They've already done that. They have put us, and this is the Republicans and the profiteering Democrats who agreed to Medicare Part C and Medicare Part D, so we don't have to, no, we don't negotiate for prescription drugs. We pay full price here. And Part C is, you know, the right-wing wet dream. Oh, it's private. You know, it's all for-profit corporations who benefit from this. And we, the taxpayers, pay a boatload more money into that to give more generous benefits to about 1/4 of the people who sign up for it. Because they wanted to pull everyone away from the mandated part of Medicare, the Part A and Part B. And I think absolutely everyone in this country, every person in this country should be covered by Medicare Part A. And that's the hospitalization. That's where if you get sick and you have your cancer or whatever you got, you have to go into the hospital, you have protection. You're not going to go bankrupt, hopefully. Every single person. And then you start from there. But it was Part C that they rammed through. Got to have this Part C. It's our private world. So when you hear Obama talking about, well, we're going to save some money from Medicare. That's where he's talking about taking money out of and saying, look, we need to get everybody in the same pot. And understand, that's how this system is supposed to work. You have one pot. And everybody throws in. And everybody gets coverage. Which is why what's distressing to me is you got these courts who are saying, well, you know, the mandate for people to buy health care, that's somehow unconstitutional. But everybody's got to throw into Medicare and everyone's got to throw into Social Security. So I'm trying to figure that one out. Maybe this is the decision where the Republicans and then go back and say, well, you know what? You did it for this. Let's destroy that stuff. Worrying down the road. But, you know, the reality of this is, look, if everyone's not in, the system will collapse because you will have free riders. You're going to have people who tear this entire thing down. And for me, as I said, Medicare Part A is something that we should have the second we're born, and it should follow us until the day we die. Because then there's somebody who's got some interest in the game. There's someone who's got, some skin, if you will, to use a Republican frame. so that we don't end up having these for-profit companies pushing people off onto the backs of Medicare by denying care. Just common sense to me. Common sense. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Casey Miner. He's with the folks out at WKAWL Radio out in San Francisco. We're right back after this.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The battle continues, and we must stay united until we get a fair contract. I want to thank all of my union brothers and sisters, both from landline and the wireless side, for their support in this fight. This is a true David and Goliath story being played out right now. David will once again win.
CWA Local 1101's Danny Gutierrez on the Verizon strike ending today. Striking Verizon workers return to work today under indefinite extensions of their existing collective bargaining agreements. Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says the unity that striking CWA and IBEW workers demonstrated in their two-week strike will continue, along with continued union mobilization, until a new collective bargaining agreement is won at Verizon.
That will go on not only until we have a decent contract, but until working people feel like they can join a union, any union, and bargain with their head held high across this country. We should return united as much as we can, marching in together, literally, at the start of a shift. For now, our unity will be to support the bargaining team and to show it. But if that process doesn't work in the weeks ahead, management absolutely knows that that unity will again be directed at them.
Cohen says the unions and working Americans everywhere need to build a new democracy movement to battle corporate power's assault on the middle class. Miles Calvi is IBEW Local 2222 business manager.
In good faith, we've decided to have our members go back and see if we can at least change the process. The process up to this point has been 100% concessionary, and as we explained to the company, even if we were crazy enough to come to a tentative agreement, it would never be accepted by the membership, so it was a complete waste of time.
He says a company like Verizon, with more than $106 billion a year in revenue, can't just dump health care costs on the backs of workers.
What a corporation that brings in $107 billion a year and has operating income profits of over $3 billion, if they decide that they're not going to help out on the health care issues, then we are in serious trouble.
Calvi says as Verizon workers get back to work and collective bargaining resumes, the public can help the unions build a democracy movement that defends the dream of a strong American middle class.
Any communication they have with Verizon, just tell them how outrageous it was, that it wasn't just an attack on their employees, it's an attack on the middle class in this country.
The AFL-CIO is submitting more than 21,000 public comments from workers who want to see new NLRB union election rules adopted. The proposed rules would speed up union elections and help ensure that workers who want to vote to have a union have a fair choice. The AFL-CIO says working people overwhelmingly support the new NLRB election standards, despite a torrent of politically motivated attacks on the rules from companies and anti-union organizations.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I wanna be the same child of God.
Yeah, you may remember a couple of weeks back we were talking about the Bay Area Rapid Transit, the BART system out there in San Francisco, where they had turned off the communications on the train lines, so people couldn't use their cell phones and they were unable to communicate by text or any of that stuff. And you know, we had a guest on talking about, you know, what's going to happen. Well, you know, now Anonymous came in and they published all of the email addresses and all the contacts for the people who work for BART, and this thing is kind of snowballing. And here to help us talk a little bit about what's going on is Casey Miner. She's a reporter on transportation for KALW Public Radio in San Francisco, and she also does the Transportation Nation blog. Casey, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Tell me, what's going on today? What's the situation now?
Well, today people are really just kind of looking at, you know, the fallout and getting the numbers and figuring out the aftermath of the protests that happened during the commute hour yesterday evening. Last night, as it did last Monday, a couple hundred protesters went down to the downtown BART stations to make their opinions known about the police shooting of Charles Hill and also the BART cell phone shutdown. And they ended up having a march down Market Street. A couple stations were closed intermittently and several arrests were made. And so today it's really just kind of figuring out what all happened, how many people were arrested, what was the effect in ridership on BART, that kind of thing.
Right. So let me ask you, because some of the reports that I've seen put it as high as 50 being arrested and claim that, you know, things turned violent, you know, in today's sensationalized media. Is that accurate?
I mean, there were definitely some isolated reports of violence. You know, there was a bystander, for example, who ran at some demonstrators and started punching them. There were a couple people who threw trash cans into the street, that kind of thing. You know, most of the arrests didn't take place until the very end of the night when people were gathered around the Civic Center Plaza. And those arrests were made by SFPD and not the BART police themselves.
Yeah,
so violent might be a little bit of a stretch.
A little stretch. Yeah, because anytime you get a couple hundred people together, you're going to have a couple of idiots who do dumb things.
Sure. And I think, you know, throughout this, the BART police have been sort of adamant in talking about how their main concern is operating the transit system and preserving the safety of the passengers on the BART platforms. And so I think that was their primary concern. As far as what SFPD's crowd control strategies were, I can't speak as much to that. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think anytime you have a demonstration, there's certainly a likelihood of something like that happening.
Do you think by you know, causing kind of an outrage with the turning off the cell phones and turning off the internet, I guess, do you see the protesters being more active? Do you see this growing from here? Because part of me is, you know, kind of angry that they pulled this stunt when maybe it would have just fizzled out.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to say. At this point, I think people are torn. You know, a lot of the kind of bystanders who I spoke to yesterday were saying that, you know, they actually really sympathized with the demonstrators and they, you know, they didn't think that the cell phone shutoff was a good idea. They didn't think the BART police should be shooting people. But at the same time, they wanted to go home to their families. They wanted to leave their jobs and they kind of felt like the demonstrators were targeting the wrong people. And so, I mean, I think that there is some frustration at BART and they have been on the defensive about this for the past several weeks, but in terms of whether this kind of protest movement is really spreading, I think we're going to have to wait and see. There is the BART board is having a special meeting tomorrow morning specifically to discuss the cell phone shutdown and kind of assess its policy options and whether it needs to adopt a specific policy about this. And I think turnout at that meeting will be a really good indication of kind of where public sentiment is with this right now.
Is there any movement on the FCC complaint, I guess, that's been filed?
So when I talked to the FCC today, they told me that they are still looking into the matter. It's not a full investigation. They called it an assessment. So they're really just looking to see whether any FCC rules were violated by BART when they made this decision. The person who I spoke with said that they didn't have any final information on that, and they were still assessing it. So I guess we'll have to wait and see a little bit on that as well.
Yeah, because part of me, you know, looks at some of the legislation that's been being kicked around, you know, about the internet kill switch and things like that. And it makes me wonder if we may see more of this in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real issue. And people have framed this one in a couple of different ways. I mean, one of the arguments that's being made is, well, you know, BART doesn't have to provide cell phone service. That's an amenity and not a necessity. So therefore, they have to write shut it down. And of course, the counter to that is, you know, they do provide cell phone service. And given that they do that and they're a government agency, they don't necessarily have the right to be unilaterally shutting off people's communications, especially as a preemptive measure. But, you know, this is unprecedented in the U.S. I mean, it's something that we've seen examples of in various ways in other countries over the course of this year, but it's really not something that's been tested here. And so there's certainly a possibility that this will be a test case, and I think people are watching pretty closely to see what ends up happening and how big a First Amendment issue this ends up being.
Well, I saw on Twitter they had the name Mubart Tech.
Exactly.
You know, kind of a takeoff of Bart and Mubarak, which, if his shoe fits, I guess.
Sure. I mean, there are definitely some people who have made that comparison, and I think that, you know, Bart has defended those actions and has not rolled back its defense of those actions even a little bit. So in terms, I don't think it'll be something that we necessarily find a middle ground on. But again, you know, the BART board is in a position to make some decisions about this and actually set some policy, possibly as early as this meeting tomorrow morning. And so we may get a little bit more clarity on the BART organization's official position on this going forward.
And, well, depending on what they say, is this a city, an issue where the city would step in, the state, the federal government? Let's say they say we're going to shut this off anytime we want. And here are our criteria for doing that. Is there something that the folks of San Francisco or California can have a say in that?
BART is a regional organization. It is a public agency. It's funded by state and federal and local funds. But in terms of what their procedure would be, I think somebody would have to object legally if BART did make that decision and somebody like the ACLU or another organization felt like it was unconstitutional and in violation of state or federal law. I think they would certainly make that known.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Casey Miner. She's a reporter for KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. She also does the Transportation Nation blog. Let me ask you this. You know, with all of this protesting going on, the issue of why they're there could have gotten muddled a little bit. Do you think that this is going to do anything for the actual reason they're there, which is the shooting of this man?
Well, right. I mean, at this point, you know, that is certainly one of the reasons they're there. I think the cell phone shutdown and the subsequent hacking of the BART website by the members of Anonymous has kind of gotten a little bit more media attention recently, but there is an ongoing investigation of the shooting at BART. I mean, it is, you know, it's the third police shooting in 3 years by BART police. They've recently hired an independent police investigator as well as appointed a citizen review board that is supposed to have access to every aspect of BART's internal investigation, the police's internal investigation. We haven't heard anything from that yet, so it's hard to say what conclusions they're coming to. When I spoke with the police auditor, he told me that he's reviewing all of the videos, he's talking to the people involved, he's looking at all the relevant documents, but we haven't seen a whole lot of what that really includes yet. So I think that when those reports come out and when some kind of conclusion is reached is when you'll see a little bit more of a discussion of that.
So aside from the meeting, I guess, like, as you said, it's happening tomorrow night. What plans are in place that you may know of going forward from this point on?
The only thing, aside from the fact that there's a BART board meeting about this tomorrow morning, the only other thing are rumors of a possible protest again next Monday. Some people are tweeting about it. Some people have mentioned maybe expanding it to East Bay BART stations. It's not something that's really coalesced yet. I think it's something that BART is certainly monitoring also, but we'll have to wait and see. It may be that next Monday at 5 p.m. we're having this discussion again.
And it appears to be somewhat semi-fluid, so I guess they don't send out press releases, do they?
No, they typically don't, although they are very active active tweeters, and so I think that if there is going to be something next Monday, we will know. And BART seems to be monitoring as well. They notified people about yesterday's demonstration starting on Sunday. They were advising people to maybe try and find alternate routes home. So I think that people are watching very carefully to see what will happen.
So lastly, yesterday when this was going on, did they shut down cellular service on the BART platforms while the protest was going on?
Not as far as I know, and I've heard no reports of that. I was down on the Civic Center platform. I think it's something that people would have mentioned if they'd noticed it. They had a bunch of police down there. There were a bunch of media. They let people stay down there for about 20 minutes, and then they declared an unlawful assembly and closed the station. So to the best of my knowledge, that's not something that they've done again.
Well, we will continue to follow this. Casey Miner, I appreciate the time and the update. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Casey Miner. She's a reporter on transportation for KALW Public Radio. We've got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Casey's name. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
From all things dark and cruel, now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Maybe you thought after George W.'s presidency that at least it can't get worse than that. Well, don't look now, but here comes worse. High strutting out of Bush's Texas, shooting from the lip, smugger and stupider than you would think possible, Rick Perry, the slap-happy Texas governor, says he's ready to be president. This guy puts the dumb in dumbfounding. In just his first couple of weeks as a candidate, he has turned prayer into a political spectacle, crowed ceaselessly that he's the rooster who makes the economic sun come up, flat out lied that federal regulators are coming after farmers' tractors, and declared that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, a Bush appointee, is a traitor who should get beaten up. Worst of all, though, was his flagrant insult to America's military men and women fighting in the brutal Iraqi and Afghanistan wars. In a flabby roundhouse punch thrown at President Obama's lack of military experience, Perry claimed that he would be the soldiers' favorite because they had won a commander-in-chief who had, quote, worn the uniform. While it's true that Perry wore the uniform as an Air Force transport pilot, he never got his uniform dirty, much less bloody. He mostly flew around the U.S. and Europe, hauling, as he himself once put it, the colonel's kitty litter. Never went anywhere near a shooting war. Real soldiers have a term for the likes of Perry, who strutted around as a warrior but dodged any encounters with live munitions. They say that the loud-talking governor served in, quote, the chair force. This is Jim Hightower saying, let me put this as bluntly as I can. Rick Perry is a fraud. For him to suggest that he has, quote, done what these men and women in the military are doing is a grotesque insult. That alone says he's not worthy of even being considered for the highest office in our land. Shame on him.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green.
And that's the thing. So what are we leaving to our children? If we're doing this whole cut, gut, and punish thing, if we're slashing, burning, if we're doing what the Republicans want to do, what's that going to leave down the road? You know, they keep talking about, oh, well, we're going to solve our debt problems by eliminating all economic activity, by allowing the economy to slow down to a point where we end up in a depression. You know, I got to be honest, the more I look at this, the more I just, my head's about to explode. And I got an email, and I'm on a bunch of these right-wing email chain lists. And, I got a whole bunch of lists of people from the radical Christian, the angry sect of Christianity. So I get a lot of this email stuff, and I kind of monitor their level of insanity. But this one caught my attention because, as I've been saying for some time, there has to be some common ground. There has to be a way to reach across the aisle and say, even to the teabaggers, that there are some things that are universal. There are some things that are not right, not left, not liberal, not conservative, just correct. You know, it's not a matter of right and left. It's a matter of right and wrong. And this just seems to me to smack of just plain wrong. And in the subject title, it says downright disgusting. and it's about General Electric, and we talked about it last night. They're planning to move their 115-year-old X-ray division from Waukesha, Wisconsin, one of the most conservative places in the country, to Beijing. So again, this isn't right or left. This is about right and wrong. So they're moving it from Waukesha, Wisconsin, to Beijing. They're moving the headquarters, the company. They're going to invest $2 billion in China. They're going to train more than 65 engineers. They're going to create 6 research centers. This is the email. And it says this is the same GE that made $5.1 billion in the United States last year but paid no taxes, the same company that employs more people overseas than it does in the United States. I've read that verbatim. That was in the right-wing email. Either somebody listened to me last night and decided to come up with a right-wing email, or this is universal. And they write, so let me get this straight. President Obama appointed GE Chairman Jeff Immelt to head his Commission on Job Creation, the Job Czar, in parentheses. Immelt is supposed to help create jobs. And here's the under part. I guess the president forgot to tell him which country he was supposed to be creating those jobs in. Now, this comes from one of my more radical right Tea Party-leaning email lists. So there is common ground, and there is an opportunity for us to say, you know what, these big multinationals, and you know, I got to be honest, I kind of shook my head for a second, because as I had said from the beginning, I could have been a Tea Party person. I would have been right there. I'm as angry as anybody that the criminals on Wall Street have robbed us blind. I'm as angry as anybody that they've screwed us constantly on this mortgage deal. The $1.2 trillion in free money that we gave to the likes of Bank of America and Morgan Stanley, just I want to rip my hair out over, because I told you it was going to happen. And I told everybody what we should have been doing, and there should have been a movement to push for that. Reopen the Home Ownership Loan Corporation. Now, the government says we're going to buy those mortgages at market value. We're going to pay back the banks. The banks are going to take a haircut. And the people who own the houses are going to have to pay for them over 30 years at a certain rate. And everybody moves on. We help the banks survive. The homeowner survives. The economy stabilizes. We didn't do that. Why? Because we needed to fatten the bottom lines of the Wall Street types. We needed to make sure that the big banks got bigger and bigger and bigger. And now you're looking at this $1.2 trillion. Could have saved some 6.5 million people from foreclosure. But now that's not what we're about. Not what we're about at all. And this is where I reach out to the Tea Party people. Look, private for-profit corporations have a place in our economy. Absolutely. But they should not be running our country. We should be. Through our government, and not the government we have now. I agree. I'm as unhappy as anybody, because it's not working for you and me. It's not working for the working people. It's working for the investor class, boy. When you see this whole attack on raising taxes on the Buffetts and the Kochs and all the other billionaires, and you've got an entire party who's anti doing that and wanting to raise taxes on the 46% of the people who, well, they don't pay any federal tax. Yeah, because they don't make any money. Tell me where your priorities are. Explain that to me. And then you look at the party who said, well, we're going to be the party. You know, I've got it here. I've got the grand pledge right here on my desk. We're going to be the party of jobs, jobs, jobs. We're going to be the party of restoring confidence in Congress. We're going to be more honest. We're going to be accountable. We're going to run government the way it should be. Lowest approval rating in history right now. The lowest in history. Never been lower than it is right now. But I will tell you, in a couple of months, it'll probably drop even further. And what you're seeing is 60% of the House members going, we don't want to go out and talk to those people. Don't want to see it. In fact, this group named No Labels, they claimed in one of their reports that some 60% of House members, they're not holding any open town halls, nothing. Sorry, not happening, can't do it. half of the Republicans are hiding behind closed doors. And you look at our freshman T. Twizzler up the road here, Lou Barletta, the right-wing, you know, hero. He's holed up in some back room somewhere. People are out there protesting, going, "Hey, Lou, where are the jobs? Where are the jobs you promised?" You know what he offered? He offered to have a pay-per-view public event. Yeah, you can pay. You know, this is how conservatives want to run government. This is how the profiteers would run our government. We pay for it. We pay their salaries. We pay for their offices. We pay for all of it. But if we want to have access to them, just like the big donors in the who run the multinational corporations, you got to pay, man. This is pay for play, or in this case, pay per view. So the more money, it's all about the money to these people. It's not about good governance. It's not about actually having programs that benefit we, the working people, we, the people that live here. No, it's not about that. It's about how do we fatten the bottom line. And the reality is I think people are waking up to the fact that these guys are a bunch of charlatans. They're a bunch of snake oil salesmen. And I look at this guy in Ohio, this Chabot, Stephen Chabot. He decided, yeah, I'm going to have a town hall, but you know what? In my town hall, nobody will be allowed to have a camera. And a big sign all over the place, signs all over the halls. For security purposes, cameras not permitted. For security purposes, I can't take a picture. For security purposes, I can't record it. Whose security are we talking about? I would submit that the security that he's worried about is the security of Stephen Chabot. Because he's going to say something stupid. And the working people of this country are going to wake up and realize that people like him, his ilk, don't really care about you and me. They don't care about the 90% of the people in this country who make on average about $31,000 a year. You are not important to him. Because you're not filling his campaign coffers. The people that are important, that top 1%, those folks, you know, in the nice comfortable range, the 400 people who control more than half of the wealth of this country, that 400 people who have more combined wealth than half of this nation, stop and think about that for a minute. And yet we've got people running around saying, well, you know, Obama's talking about redistribution of wealth. You're damn right he is, and I hope he does it more. Haven't heard it from him in a while. I'd like to hear it again. I'd like a tax code that's going to say, you know what, people at the bottom, we're going to help you a little bit. People at the top, you're going to have to kick in. It's part of being a member of society. You don't like it, there's a country across the bay. Go over and talk to them. Oh, gee, they tax higher. So Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, a bunch of unemployed people decided, you know what, we're going to go to his office and say, you know what, we read the pledge too. We're the jobs. So Paul Ryan said, well, I'm going to be like Barletta because, you know, I guess this must have come out of one of the right-wing think tanks. Yeah, to have pay-per-view town hall meetings. Do it online where you can be all by yourself and you don't have to actually talk to anybody you don't want to. Do a pay-per-view thing. You can raise money for it, yes. So the unemployed folks are going like, we don't have any money. We can't afford to go. They went and they sat in his office. Said, you know what, we want to talk to this guy. He's our representative. He's the guy that we pay. He's our guy. He's supposed to be helping us. Where is he? Well, turns out they called the police on these folks again. And as we talked about last week, they did it again and again. So the staff, you know, threatened to call the police to have these folks arrested. Why? Because they didn't have $15 to throw in to watch the little baby Jesus himself give the Sermon from the Mount about how right-wing ideology is so wonderful and about how he himself benefited from the largesse of government, how he himself benefited from Social Security survivor benefits. That's how he claims how he got through college. But now that he has benefited from it, he's going to give the sermon on why it's bad. See, it didn't do for him. No, it was bad. Bad. And you go, really? Are these the people who are running this country? Are these the people who told us jobs, 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 restored faith in government, transparency, accountability? Are these the same people? And time again, we keep hearing these same people who were the proud T-Twizzlers out there causing a ruckus in 2010. They're the ones who are shutting it out now. These are the ones who are telling you, sorry. We don't want to hear from you. We know what we're doing. We have an edict. We have decided that more tax cuts, more deregulation, more trickle-up economics. We need to give the money to the wealthy, and then it'll rain down on us, as it has not for the last 30 years. But again, you don't go away from a good frame. Focus group tested, think tank approved. And you look at this whole plan, man. It doesn't benefit you or me. And how many of the mouthpieces out there in the media do you hear standing up for working people? I see a scant few. What I see is a millionaire class of entertainers who have been given the political word and saying, this is what you need. We spent a lot of money with Frank Luntz, and we spent a lot of money in our think tanks and with our focus groups, and we spent a lot of money putting this very nice, simple-minded message together. Very short, very simple. Those common people can figure it out. And we'll just beat them with it constantly. Tax cuts good, tax cuts good, tax cuts good. Tax cuts for who? I would agree. Tax cuts are stimulative when the people who are getting them actually spend the money. This idea that if we give the very wealthy all of this money, that they're going to use it in the right way, to me, is simply misguided. Because for them, it's about making more profit. And where is there more profit to be made? Out of this country. You can exploit cheap labor all around the globe. If you're smart, that's where you're going to invest that money, not here. Because we have trade policies here that have put this nation at a disadvantage. We've allowed the Koch brothers and the investor class to dictate policy and trade policies that have put us at a disadvantage where, those jobs that my grandfather's generation raised a family on, those hard-working middle-class factory jobs and those jobs driving truck that paid a reasonable living where one person could work and mom could stay home and raise the kids, those days are done because they have pitted us against every exploitable worker and every environmental catastrophe that could come. And then they tell us, well, the reason that we're not creating jobs here is because you workers want too much. You want health care. You want pensions. You want to be able to feed your children. Oh, and you want air you can breathe and water you don't have to slice with a knife? Well, we just can't do business in that environment. And that's where we are, folks. Simple, simple stuff. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, Visit AppsMe13.org.
We are AppsMe.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in the shaken town of Washington, D.C., Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, how are we doing tonight?
Well, it was definitely shaking. I was on the air at the time. And at first, because we're so close to the Capitol, our office, we thought it might be terrorism. In fact, I have to pay extra for insurance because we're considered a terrorism area. Then I began to think, well, maybe it was this lousy old building we're in. And then we realized it was an earthquake. And the Capitol, I mean, people were in the train station. It's 150 years old, the train station. And people were running out of there. It was really quite scary for most people in Washington.
Yeah, underground I don't think would be the best place to be during an earthquake.
And not at all. and really, again, a lot of people weren't in town, so that was good news. But everything from the Pentagon to the Capitol was shaking.
Yeah, well, my producer felt it here. I didn't. I got to be honest, I didn't feel it. But he said he felt it when it happened. So, it got this far. Which tells me it was a pretty substantial earthquake. So how many buildings fell down? How much massive damage? This is a pretty good size earthquake, correct?
5.8 on the Richter scale is it's not Haiti, which was 7, but it wasn't a 3 either. And the fact is that this is a time today the government put out some issues on reducing regulations. The Republicans are saying it's not enough. But what's amazing, Rick Smith, is that without these regulations, with this kind of earthquake, we would be like Haiti. A lot of the city would be rubble. And because of the very strong building code we have in this country, there was basically no damage.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the countries like Haiti, and the first thing I thought of was Haiti and what happened there, because when you throw up basically cardboard shacks, what do you think happens when you allow people just to throw things up without any oversight or any concern for, what's going to happen? That's what you get.
Or you don't have rules about cement, what kind of mixture, all that kind of thing. That is the kind of that's the kind of regulations that we need in this country. And now the Obama administration has taken the initiative, mind you, the Bush administration did not, to get rid of regulations that don't work and that don't make sense. And all they're getting is criticism from the Chamber of Commerce saying this is really going to change the economy. This is basically a drop in the bucket. Well, okay, get rid of regulations like building codes, get rid of regulations like the FDA, and then see what happens in this country.
But isn't that their point? We should be able to do whatever we want, whenever we want, to whoever we want, so that we can profit right now and the future be damned and anyone who we harm be damned.
Well, that's right, and that's exactly why people got back to, well, they didn't get back to work. The Capitol wasn't really open until 5 o'clock, but that's why we have a Washington, D.C. Tonight and an East Coast that is in good shape because we do have those building codes and because we have not completely gutted them, although if Ronald Reagan was around, he would have tried to get his little mist on those too.
Well, if you remember, and it was Cantor who wanted to do away with the very regulation that would oversee this. In fact, I was reading something today that the one nuke plant there in Virginia, they had taken out the seismograph because of budget cuts. And again, you know, you look at this and you start to think, really, our nuke plant doesn't have this kind of stuff in it?
That's right. I mean, again, I think that given the tsunami where the vice president was actually just yesterday talking to the people and knowing what we went through and knowing the regulations that we have in place, I mean, every American ought to be thankful that we do have that kind of oversight.
Yeah.
It's called government. They make, the right one might call it big government. We just call it government.
Yeah, I mean, it was just March of this year that Cantor defended Republicans wanting to gut the USGS and the National Weather Service. And you go...
Yeah, well, he's going to have a lot of trouble now because he's going to look like a fool after people talk about what happened with an earthquake.
But here's the thing. Our president also talking about cutting regulation. You know, everything's on the table according to the Super 12 and all the reports that I've seen. I'm hoping that this fervor to cut regulation, which seems to be, you know, brought to us by the folks on the right, kind of slowed down by this.
Well, I think some of the regulations do make sense that they issued today. And again, the reason I'm convinced they make sense is because the Chamber of Commerce and the right was carping about it as soon as the government released the regulation, basically saying that these weren't very many at all, wasn't really going to change any jobs, wasn't going to change the trillions of dollars or whatever that they consider we put towards regulation. But remember, you know, they say all these regulations cost money. Well, you know, think about it. They also make money for the economy because obviously if you have regulations around building codes, it means you have to make stronger steel. It means that if you have regulations around airlines, you have to make them safety. And even handicap regulations, somebody's got to make that hardware. So regulations aren't all bad for the economy.
Absolutely not. I come from the home of the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. I mean, when I was a kid, Lake Erie was dead. It was literally dead. Nothing lived there.
Guess what? I am old enough to remember when you could swim in Lake Erie before it went dead.
And here you go. You know, you're going to be 60.
And then 60. It was dead and we couldn't swim in it.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, we weren't allowed anywhere near it. It was dead because they had polluted it so badly. In comes regulation. It is now back and it's thriving. The air, you know, was polluted at one point. We had massive acid rain problems. I'm sure you remember that.
Of course.
We regulation. Smart.
And it's made a better quality of life for all of us.
And this,
try and tell that to the Republicans. Well, the Republicans, I think, got a little lesson today on earthquakes.
But I would argue that those regulations saved us tons of money in health care costs, tons of money in natural disaster costs, saves us money.
Well, again, had we not had the regulations and the very strict regulations in Washington and throughout this part of the world on earthquakes, there would have been a lot of deaths. There would have been a lot of buildings. I mean, our building shook, and the fact that it could withstand what it went through, years of regulations, years of building codes, shows that, you know, we were able to stay in our building and stay on the radio.
Yep. And finally, the big news, Libya, what's going on with Gaddafi?
Well, Gaddafi has not been found, nor his two sons, but they did go into his compound shouting, God is great. What's very interesting is that whether it's Syria or whether it's Bahrain, there has been a lot of people that are saying that those governments are next. And so we'll see what happens. But I think this is not just going to be Libya. The issue now is, and there is this little side issue. Of course, once they begin to produce oil revenue again, who gets it? Is it the NATO countries? And, of course, they will be accused, rightly or wrongly, of going into this because of the oil.
Absolutely. But, you know, at the end of this, my question is what happens? Do we end up with another petty dictator who's just as bad, if not worse?
Well, that's always the question. And can the, quote-unquote, rebel groups get it together and really hold with the democracy?
Well, let's hope so. And I hope they find him soon. I do. Alan Ratner, I appreciate the time. Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. Right back.
Guitar,
saving work in America. One show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833. And consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Hughley Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Oh, you gotta love conservative world. It's all about their profit and you getting the shaft. And, you know, during the break, we got a tweet that, you know, again, you know, it's just amplifies what I've been saying. WFPMN says, my father passed away when I was 14. Survivor benefits to my sister and I helped my mom move us to a better life. And, you know, you hear these stories of people who are going to be honest about it. You know, and I've said this a number of times on this program. I could easily look back and take a Horatio Alger vision of my life. I can easily come here every night and say how wonderful I am because I was able to pull myself up by bootstraps and now, you know, came out of the housing projects, out of the ghetto in Cleveland, and now I live in a very nice neighborhood and live a fairly middle-class existence. And it was because of my hard work and fortitude. Nobody else but me. I can easily say that. It wouldn't be true. Because along the line, there have been numerous wonderful people who have extended a helping hand. There have been numerous government programs that I have been able to benefit from. And look, that helping hand upward. And this is why I don't forget. It's very easy to forget that, you know, I did get the survivor benefits. And I did benefit from school lunch programs and summer programs and a whole bunch of stuff that turned me into the person that I am today. And now I'm paying taxes, and a good amount of them, as where a lot of the people I grew up with as kids who didn't have those opportunities, who didn't have those people who said, come this way, here's a hand up, are now costing the taxpayer. So the question then becomes, you know, we used to understand this. We did. When Benjamin Franklin was around, and, you know, even in my grandfather's generation, we got the whole an ounce of prevention, you know, worth a pound of cure. You know, we used to get it. Somehow along the way, we've lost our way. Somehow we've lost that understanding that if we invest a little bit now, it's going to save us immensely in the long term. You know, I love that commercial. Pay me now or pay me later. The question is just how much. And I look at these programs that, you know, that I myself have benefited from. And I'm now paying that back with interest. And that's why we have these things. It's for the betterment of society, so we all go up together. Pretty simple stuff. Pretty simple stuff. And I wish Paul Ryan would remember where he came from. And I wish a lot of these folks who have this, well, I did it all on my own, really stop and be a little self-critique, maybe a little honesty. A couple of quick stories to end tonight. The Hopi tribe in Arizona has filed a lawsuit. On Friday, they filed a lawsuit in Arizona Superior Court against the city of Flagstaff. Turns out that the city wants to get this wastewater that they've recollected. You know, the city flushes their toilet, whatever goes down, they reclaim that, they do whatever with it. They want to sell it to the this Snow Bowl ski resort because they're saying that, you know, when you have light snow years, their attendance drops anywhere. You know, in good years, it's about 150,000 skiers there, you know, doing their thing with the poles and the, you know, little flat pieces of wood. Bad years, 3,000. So there's money to be made. So what they want to do is they want to make this pipeline. They want this sewage water to be piped some 15 miles uphill to this reservoir, and they want to make fake snow out of it. And what's going on is, you know, in 1983, courts ruled that the pipeline wouldn't violate the tribe's First Amendment religious rights by hindering access to their spiritual lands. But here again, they're saying, wait a second, you haven't gone the whole way. The Forest Service finally approved the application to expand the resort and use the water back in 2005. Well, they're filing another suit on this. And, you know, some folks are going, do we really want to have snow made out of wastewater? You know, there's a bunch of stuff here that make you go, really? I don't know. But the Hopi tribe has argued that the contract that Flagstaff has with this Snow Bowl is illegal under the law because it will result in unreasonable environmental degradation and further deplete the limited drinking water resources. Interesting scenario, but I got to be honest, not so thrilled with the idea of making snow out of yellow water or brown water for that matter. But that's just me. I don't know if you saw this report out of Nashville. Evidently, had a little problem. Fire and emergency crews came out and they shut down I-65 south of Nashville today. They found several steaming canisters. And these canisters, they had a foul odor. So they brought out the hazmat crews and they quarantined off the area and they, you know, did a whole bunch of stuff, you know, to keep the public safe. Turns out the canisters had fallen off of a Greyhound bus, and they contained bull semen. So there you go. The highway was shut down because of a whole bunch of, well, stuff. Interesting study from Northwestern University contradicting what they had decided only 6 years ago. They have decided that bisexual men actually exist. And, again, you know, this is one of those stories where I go, are you really trying to destroy education? Are you really trying to give as much ammunition to the insane people in this country who want to destroy actual research? You know, just in 2005, they said, well, you know, it remains to be shown that male bisexuality exists. Now they've settled it. It exists. And I go, well, why do I care? And this is one of those moments where you go, I really don't care what consenting adults do within the confines of their four walls. You know, do what you got to do. You know, be happy. You know, don't put yourself in a position where you're going to be repressed and angry and pent up. This is how we end up with serial killers. And you know, whatever you got to do with consenting adults and your four walls, you do. I don't want to know about it. I don't care. And I look at this, and again, you know, you go, do we really need to have studies on this? I know people who have cancer. We should be spending a little bit of time on that, don't you think? Just a little. So again, you know, I look at that, and it's one of those things where If I were a rabid right-winger, if I were one of these crazy people who, like the woman who runs the radio program that we talked about last night, they said, well, if we won't get rid of HIV, we just cut down the gay bars. She's going to have a field day, an absolute field day with that story. Another story from Anchorage, Alaska that caught my attention. A jury there has convicted a woman of misdemeanor child abuse. Turns out this woman, her name is Jessica Beagley. She's 36, lives in Anchorage, Alaska. You may know her better as the Hot Sauce Mom. She and her husband, they adopted two children from these twins from Russia. And evidently, and this is where it gets kind of weird for me, she made videos of herself disciplining her children, or the one kid, for putting hot sauce in the kid's mouth and then forcing him to take cold showers, which, I'm not getting the whole hot and cold thing, but the jury said, you know, you sent these off to Dr. Phil, and Dr. Phil didn't think you were crazy, but we do. So she's been found guilty. They concluded that, you know what, you hurt your kid, and really just for an audience on a TV show, which is really kind of weird. Her lawyer said, you know, she wanted to be and still wants to be a good mom. I'm going, I really don't know that putting hot sauce in a kid's mouth is punishment of someone who wants to be a good mom. Anyway, she's scheduled for sentencing soon. She faces up to a $10,000 fine and could see prison terms of 1 year. I haven't seen whether they're going to be able to keep the kids, and I got to wonder, you know, given the sensitivity that these kids were adopted from Russia, given not too long ago there was a kid that was killed who was adopted from Russia, and there's some sensitivity there. I don't know how this woman can keep these kids. I don't know how the state doesn't step in and say, sorry, we're... No. You can't even have a puppy. Because I wouldn't give the woman a puppy. You know, in fact, you can't even have a fly in the house. Because that's just weird. I'm going to put hot sauce in you. That just, you know, I understand a smack across the backside. I get that. My mother did it enough. But that's just nuts. You want to talk about journalistic excellence? You know, I love to bash on the mainstream corporate-controlled media and their message machine. But this is pure journalistic excellence. This, you know, I wish we could find who the guy's professor was in college. Because this is verbatim the words of a TV reporter on a station in Lorain County, Ohio. He said police are looking for a sex-crazed loser who crashed a stolen semi-truck into an old adult store early Monday morning and swiped a very expensive XXX toy. It happened around 2 a.m. at Adult Mart on Cooper Foster Park Road. Cops say the sexual deviant wasn't screwing around either. Once he drove the big rig into the Lorain County store, he headed straight for an $800 sex toy. It is described as a lifelike masturbator complete with female genitalia, with legs and buttocks. Police say he had to have dropped off the anatomically correct sex toy someplace because police found him in the semi and the man was still in it a quarter mile from where it was stolen. But the sex toy was not in the cab. Once the freak says he saw the cops, he jumped out of the truck and ran down some nearby railroad tracks, getting away. The Lorain County Sheriff's Department say that the pervert stole the red truck from the JT Container Company on Wolford Avenue in Elyria. If you have any information on this sticky-fingered perv, give cops a call. And I'm going, yeah, wait a second. Is that real reporting? I mean, do we know that the guy is a sexual deviant? Do we know he's a pervert? Do we know he's a perv? Do we know all that? I don't think so. You know, why couldn't you give the actual report so that people aren't just a thought? You know, the guy broke into a store, stole some stuff. Here's the video. They didn't show the video. Oh, gee, journalistic integrity. You know, maybe he needed the money. Who knows? And then, you know, an $800 sex toy? Really? They make those? Wow. Somebody needs a job. And evidently, you'd have to steal them because they're probably not worth that much. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests today on the program. I had some great conversations. You know, the Hershey thing to me is still huge. You know, one of these things that we're going to have to follow continuously because, look, at the end of all of this, we have some serious labor relation problems in this country, and we really need labor law reform. And I look at that, and I'm hoping it gets the attention nationally that I think it deserves so that we start looking at how labor law in this country affects working people. And I give all those kids who are here in this country on a J-1 visa all the credit in the world for standing up and saying, you know what, I'm tired of getting screwed. I'm tired of being exploited. I'm going to fight back. My only hope is that the American workers see that and take that message home with them and say, you know what, if these kids from all over the world who are, some of them live under the rule of petty dictators, can stand up and fight back, so can I. That's what I'm hoping comes of this. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, go to thericksmithshow.com. Download it right there. Have a great night. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.